Tonight on The Download, Chicago pastor Corey Brooks, homeless advocate Nelly Vasquez Rowland, and our resident philosopher, Professor Al Genie. Now, here is your host, a man who is thinking of growing a fall ponytail, Justin Kaufman.
I mean, now that the heat's over, why not, right? Why not settle into a nice, fluffy, balding ponytail? You got to say, those are underrated. The bald guys who can grow it out on the side and grow it long, put it in a ponytail. Got nothing up top, but all on the sides. Like, there's the Dr. Katz dentist look, which is the fluffy sides, but I'm talking about going deeper, like a 3 or 4 year project where it just keeps growing out. And I'm able to take that, put a little rubber band, squeezy, and look like an eternal grad student. That's it's good to have goals. That's what I'm looking for this fall, winter in Chicago. Hey, it's Download 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. We got a great show lined up on this night in which the Chicago Cubs will clinch the NL Central. The Chicago Cubs in St. Louis with a victory tonight, and they will take what'll be their third trip to the playoffs straight. I mean, that's just unheard of. We throw this unprecedented word around. But I remember being a kid in 1984, 1989, where it was always felt to be winning a division was a once-in-a-lifetime thing. Even last year, the year before, there was this feel that this was it. Now we're getting closer and closer to meh, which I guess is a good thing. That's a good sport thing to be meh. Wake me when we get past the divisional playoffs, right? So the Cubs in St. Louis tonight, they will clinch the division if they beat the Cardinals or the Milwaukee Brewers lose. Now, the only issue is the Milwaukee Brewers in the second inning are already up 4-0. That, hey, that's early. So we'll have it here tonight. If not, we'll play the worst, 312-981-7200. You know what's the worst? When you plan to cover the clinching of the NL North, NL Central, and it doesn't happen.
Well, I kind of want Milwaukee to win and the Cubs to win, because if you recall, last year they had one of those fake parties where they lost the game and then they waited and then
somebody, you know, worst.
It's like, that's the worst.
The worst, yeah. The worst
when
is when you
back
into
the playoffs.
Yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely right. Yeah, so we don't want that. But 312-981-7200, Claire Zelke and Wendy McClure will join us tonight if there's no clinch. If there's clinch, Mark Carman will be in studio. Look at us, multitasking. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour, we got some great people coming in studio. Pastor Corey Brooks will be here to talk about a new employment and opportunity center he is cutting the ribbon on tomorrow with Governor Rauner on the south side of Chicago in the Woodlawn neighborhood. He's taking an old Walgreens, which was a very controversial closing. When the Walgreens went under and left Woodlawn, the residents there were upset because they lost a pharmacy and a potential food source. And Pastor Corey Brooks steps in and he creates a opportunity and learning center. We're going to talk with him coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Also, Nelly Vasquez Rowland will join us, the executive director over at a Safer Haven Foundation. We had her on because they had a run over the summertime. We had a really interesting conversation about homelessness in town. And with the tent city things that happened last week, where the judge in court order move the tent city out of the uptown neighborhood underneath the viaducts at Lawrence and Wilson. We in the media and everybody else goes, well, I guess that's all wrapped up. But for hundreds of homeless people, there's nowhere to go. Where are they going? What's the status of the homeless population in Chicago? Is it growing? Well, I mean, just having a tent city in itself tells us something's up. We'll talk with Nelly coming up in the 9 o'clock hour about what she sees from her perch over there. Also at 8 o'clock tonight, the importance of being funny. Professor Al Genie's got his new books. It's great. I love it. Al Genie, of course, the professor comes in, our resident philosopher. He comes in once a month or so. Talk about the big ticket items in society, whether it be the seven deadly sins or happiness. Tonight, we talk humor and how important joke tellers and telling jokes are in our society. Not only do they give you a smile, maybe put a smile on your face, but they serve as a distraction and actually go back throughout centuries to show the way humor has been used for human beings, for humankind. So we'll talk about that. And coming up here, download on Chicago Business 730, Jacob DeHart, the co-founder of Threadless, in with his new venture, Porcini, which is a new app to help organize the back end of kitchens and restaurants, an area that is in dire need of it. So we'll talk with him. So all that coming up tonight, news, weather, and traffic with Rob Martier and Esmeralda Leon, production provided by Pete Zimmerman. I'm Justin Kaufman, and this is The Download, a show about Chicago starring those who know it well. All right, we'll take a break. We'll do the carry out. Stay with us. All right, so Download here on 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Let's carry out. Here are today's top stories. Slow news. What'd I miss? No healthcare vote? Yeah. Puerto Rico destroyed? Yeah. Tax cuts for the rich? Nah. President Trump went back to his raw red meat bag and went after protesting athletes for disrespecting the flag in the NFL? Did their best act like they cared and collectively protested the anthem on Sunday? Did I get it? Survey says? Ding, ding, ding. I bet we're going to find out that the NFL owners actually took money from protesters or for Swanson knee pads or something like that. As Deadspin pointed out, the NFL seized upon this controversy to promote, quote, unity against the president, but conveniently forgot about the issue that players were kneeling about in the first place. They found a way to capitalize on the controversy without actually having to partake in the controversy. Brilliant! Pay those marketing guys more money. It's not about covering up brain injuries. It's about kneeling in front of a flag. All right, good. We got it. We figured it out. Good. Make commemorative jerseys for the moment. And don't mention race. President Trump, of course, is once again at the center of this controversy because he loves to be. President Hot Take once again riled everybody up with his words. And the joke is, this is not new. Trump's been railing on Colin Kaepernick for a year and a half now. When he gets stuck in a rut or doesn't have anything to brag about, he goes back to his best of, and he pulls out Kaepernick. Trump is like the Counting Crows getting up on stage and trying out new experimental stuff. And then when they're not really feeling it and the crowd's kind of smattering, they're like, heck with it. Mr. Jones and me. And we're all like, yeah. That's essentially it, right? Did I nail it? I nailed it. But maybe this time he went too far. The hilarious thing is that Trump's strange tirade in Alabama has succeeded in making Colin Kaepernick this generation's Martin Luther King. And even if MLK had a better completion percentage. Frankly, the media, including this show, talk shows, have turned this into how to treat the flag. But the whole point of kneeling in front of a flag or, I don't know, sitting at a lunch counter you're not supposed to, is to protest social injustice. So your fellow Americans are concerned that this country's not equal. It's not free. You really disagree with that? Regardless of your color, your creed, your background, you know that that statement's true. If it's not race or police brutality, then it's inequality or unfairness. I mean, our president ran on the campaign slogan, Make America Great Again. So you know what's up. Come on. Instead of getting mad at the messenger, maybe recognize that the message may have some merit. All right, moving on. Whitney Young High School in Chicago canceled the rest of the football season due to injury and the fact that not enough players are on the team. Oh, no, you know the game's in trouble when the smart kids give up on it. Coach, I read a piece in the Atlantic about sustained brain injuries, so I quit and I'm going to join the Glee Club. Saudi Arabia announced today they're letting women drive, and that's the carryout for September 1940. Really hope we don't go to war. That's ridiculous. I'm surprised that that story has not made it into a Trump tweet yet. Speaking of Trump tweets, Twitter is talking of expanding the 140-character limit, which was the only excuse we had against misspelling and grammatical errors. Now, if you're a dunce, if you use the wrong there, I mean, or skip apostrophes, it's on you. you no longer have the excuse of saying, I was shortening the word. I just needed less characters. And weather? Well, we're really trying to beat the heat, at least a record for heat in September. Good news. Supposed to cool off tonight, back in the 60s and 70s tomorrow. Great. Just when I bought a couple new box fans. What am I going to do with those box fans now? In sports, tonight's the night. The Cubs can clinch the NL Central with a win or a Brewers loss in St. Louis, no less. How great would that be, first off? Always great to celebrate in St. Louis. And if they win, they should only drink Coors for the post game, right? Also, remember when clinching the division was paramount to being the best moment in your sporting life? I do. I mean, it took us, what, 3 years to turn into the Yankees? I love it. I mean, don't get me wrong. Wrigleyville will still go crazy and flip a truck or throw a garbage can through a Chipotle tonight. But, I mean, come on. That's any given Saturday in that hood, so no real motivation needed. Come on, Wrigley bros. Get us on the national news tonight. Oh, no. Home run for the Cardinals, 1-0. What a nice little matchup coming up here. The Cubs looking good, ready to make this playoff run. Starts late next week against the Nationals in D.C., which kind of sucks, only because it'll be a lot of 6 p.m. starts where we got to race home to watch the start. Come on, East Coast. Get on Central Time. It's much more convenient. It's like Central Standard was the fix, right? Oh, man, we screwed up this time. So local news at 11, who's going to do? Let's redo it for the Midwest. Nice little matchup, though. Bryce Harper, Chris Bryant, Cubs fans versus Dusty Baker. I even think Edwin Jackson is on the Nationals, so maybe if he pitches, we can boo him for being so terrible when he was on the Cubs and the Sox. Something finally to bring the city together. If you care, the Bulls had their media day yesterday, and we were notified that they have parted ways with Dwayne Wade. He ate some of his contract, but we ate most of it. Now D-Wade can take his sleeveless sport coats to Cleveland or wherever else players are going these days to cherry-pick championships. If he does go back to Cleveland, listen to this. LeBron, D-Wade, and Derrick Rose. I mean, how did we get here again? What year is it? The current Bulls team, well, they told us yesterday they're really excited to watch Zach LaVine when he gets over his injury. Really? That's where we're at? That's what we're doing? I got a better idea. Since it seems like the Bulls are in a purposeful tank mode, how about lowering the price of beers and nachos for the game? Why are we paying $10 for everything when you won't pay for players? You're saving a ton of money, so pass that savings on to my chicken tenders. Right? Bears are preparing to go on the road, play the Packers at Lambeau on Thursday night. Nationally televised game. The Bears pull this one off. They get back to 2-2, and we'll definitely be paying attention. But a loss, especially a bad one, and it's apple picking for the remainder of Sundays. No pressure, guys. The Bears will have to win without safety Quinton Demps, who broke his arm on Sunday. So Adrian Amos back in at safety. I don't think Amos has an interception in his time in his Chicago or his entire career. And this is like his third or fourth year. That's not good. Also, play Trubisky. Cool. All right. Good. Slip that in. Good. And finally tonight, the vacuum company Dyson says they're getting into the electric car business. They'll have electric cars ready by 2020. Well, if the car's anything like the Dyson I have at home, it'll barely pick up kitty litter and die after about 20, 25 minutes. That sounds like a good car. That's the carryout for September 26, 2017. Hey, the last hot day of the year, so check back tomorrow where we'll offer popsicles half off. All right, coming up, Jacob DeHart's going to join us. He's the man behind Porcini, a new app that is revolutionizing the restaurant industry. He'll be my guest on the Download on Chicago Business. That's coming up right after the news. Stay with us. Rob Martier, how are you, my friend?
So what you do is you take the Dyson electric car, combine it with its bagless vacuum cleaner, and while people are driving around, they're cleaning up at the same time.
Street sweepers.
Boom!
You got to go on Shark Tank with that.
You think it'll fly?
Well, the only thing that stops us is this is where, at least for me, I get lazy. I don't want to do the paperwork to go on the show. I just want them to discover it and then say, this would be awesome. You have to be on the show in an hour and we'll fly out.
You know, Dyson's listening to the Download right now. He goes, that's brilliant.
That's brilliant.
Brilliant. With his accent, wherever he's from. Was he Swedish or something?
Yeah. It's so funny because I have the Dyson, one of the Dysons. And it's really funny because I had a house cleaner come by not too long ago. And I said, this is the vacuum. And she goes, I'll go to my car and get the vacuum. And I go, what are you talking about? I paid a lot of money for this thing. This is like, cool. She's like, that don't work with that. I was like, what? I was like, I was hoodwinked by the marketing on this thing. He's up there with the coolest show, you know, he's got like maybe a tight fitting shirt on. He's showing me how the suction works and you don't need cords anymore.
Very European.
And I lose.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time. I know what you're trying to say. You're trying to say it's time for business. It's business time.
Ooh, welcome back to the Download here on 720 WGN. It's time now for the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. This is our weekly segment where we talk with CEOs and entrepreneurs about their stories so we can better understand ours. My guest tonight was the co-founder of Threadless, the online marketplace that revolutionized not only the T-shirt business, but how many online retailers operate. Jacob DeHart left Threadless about 10 years ago, but that hasn't stopped him from continuing to innovate and start new businesses. Enter Porcini, DeHart's latest venture, which is software for the restaurant industry. After his wife opened a restaurant, he realized that the back end of the kitchen was in much need of organization. Jacob DeHart is here to talk about Porcini and his career in tech startups. Jacob, welcome to the Download in Chicago Business.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
So am I accurate in the fact that your wife had a restaurant and you recognized there was a need?
That's exactly how it came about. We started the restaurant project a couple years ago, and it was my wife's brainchild, and she found the space, and it took a while to renovate the space and find our chefs and develop all the menus and the concept. And while she was doing that, you know, I'm a tech guy, so I thought, you know, what kind of software do we need to have for the restaurant? And talking to our friends and partners who are in the industry, you know, they showed me the incumbents out there, so to speak. So for me, it was a lot of antiquated software. It was software that required you to have like a Windows computer in the restaurant. Usually it's tucked away in the basement somewhere.
Hmm.
It's software that you pay a huge license fee for, and then you pay an annual maintenance fee or service fee, support fee. And to me, it just didn't make any sense.
So essentially, we're talking about to organize staff schedules, to develop menus, put menus online, to essentially put all the work that we don't see as consumers online so it can easily be accessible and organized.
That's right. And one of the main things that we do and one of the main things that our chef partners were focused on is managing your inventory and your purchasing. So if you want your restaurant to succeed, you have to know where the money's going, and you have to know, should we be paying this much for this chicken or this fish? How much should we price that dish accordingly? And a lot of restaurants just do it in their head, or they use like a spreadsheet or something like that. And so these software solutions, they solve that, but they're so old, antiquated, and we wanted something that was easy to use in the cloud. You could use it on your Android phone, your iPhone, on a tablet, on a desktop, anywhere.
When you start getting into this business and you're creating an app and you're creating a cloud service that would take on this kind of material, what's the reaction from restaurants? Are restaurant owners and other people saying, oh, finally, my life, you saved my life? Or are there still some sort of reticent reactions and attitudes saying, I like my Windows computer in my basement?
Well, there's a mix. And so the problem is that the people that have been using these other solutions, they've been using it for a decade. You know, if the restaurant's been open, you know, for 5 years, they've been using that software for 5 years. And so there is a little bit of friction trying to get someone to transition from an old solution to a new solution. So that's why we are working on like import scripts to get them off the platform so they don't have to retype 10,000 recipes. Mm-hmm. You know, we also support catering companies, and a lot of them have literally 10,000 recipes that if they wanted to switch, they'd have to retype all that in.
Oh, right.
But for new restaurants, smaller restaurants, or restaurants that don't currently have a tech solution, then they love it. They're really open to it. It's affordable. They can see how it's possible that it'll help them save money in the long run or even in the short term.
As a businessman, as somebody who has been in the tech world, how important is it for you to listen to the restaurateurs and be able to create a software and an app that caters not only to their needs, but what they may need in the future?
There's always a balance to that, because you can't always say yes to everyone, but feedback is very important. And the way that we've been working on the software over the past year and a half is working with our chef partners at the Heritage in Forest Park, which is my wife's
restaurant. That's your wife's restaurant, right?
You know, I kind of joke around, I wanted to make software for the restaurant industry, but I haven't worked in the restaurant industry, so I opened a restaurant. It's not exactly true. It's kind of the other way around. But
it's a good tagline.
Yeah,
right,
basically, right. As I watch my partners, whether it's our general manager or our chefs, write things down in pieces of paper or print things out or have clipboards or scraps of Post-its and this and that everywhere, you know, I just think, well, how do we automate that? How do we put it in the cloud? How do we make it easier so you're not wasting 2 hours doing this?
Yeah.
you know, make it so it only takes 20 minutes, and then you have access to it, and you can search for it, et cetera.
It is interesting because the restaurant industry is a very progressive industry. I mean, they put things on plates that you never thought about before. And also, I would say, pretty antiquated in the way that it's cash, a lot of cash, overhead's pretty tight. You really are talking about a business that maybe they learned from their parents, things of that nature. So there is a lot of, I don't want to say aversion to change or tech, but there's a lot that you have to get through if you want to get into the startup business when it comes to restaurant technology.
Yeah, a lot of people just, they know what they've learned from being in the industry, whether they learned it in school or they learned it just from working in a kitchen for, you know, 5-10 years. And it is very creative industry, whether you're being creative with the dishes or being creative with the decor of a restaurant. And I think the business side of things is often overlooked. You know, when we were planning on opening the restaurant, we talked to peers and friends and said, you know, we're planning on opening this restaurant. And they said, you're crazy. Like, you know, don't you know that X number of restaurants close within the first year? And so it didn't feel very supportive. And obviously, we're not crazy people. So we looked into it, like, why are restaurants closing, this and that. And I think it's because people have good intentions, but they don't always think about the back end of it. They don't always think about the business side of things. It's not just making a nice scallop dish and serving it to your friends and family.
Because the long-time attitude or reputation of that old myth is people don't like the food or you couldn't get customers in. You know, it's just such a hard, it's a fickle business. But you're right. Really where it comes down to is the idea that the back end of the restaurant, they didn't pay attention to it, and that stuff becomes overwhelming.
Right. And so, you know, we focus on high quality, but we also need to make money. And so part of it is just focusing on having zero waste in the kitchen, knowing how much to order based on trends, knowing how much to put on an actual plate. Porcini will tell us exactly how much that plate will cost this week versus last week based on the market price of celery or something, you know. And so we can actually really tightly monitor what our margins are.
Jacob DeHart's my guest, a longtime tech startup entrepreneur in town. He was the co-founder of Threadless. His new venture, Porcini, is a restaurant software app to help with the back end of restaurants and the kitchen. We'll continue our conversation here on the Download in Chicago Business in just a sec. Stay with us.
It's business time. It's business. It's business time.
Welcome back to the Download on Chicago Business, sponsored by Signature Bank. My guest tonight was the co-founder of Threadless, the online marketplace that revolutionized not only T-shirts, but how online retail, big player. We could talk all night about that. Porcini's his latest venture. Jacob DeHart's in studio. Porcini, an app for the restaurant industry to help organize the back end of kitchens, and that's what he's working on now. What did you learn from that experience of Threadless? Because talk about disrupting. You know, we talk about it being a T-shirt business, but it almost at the last part of the business is the T-shirt. The online retail and reinventing how we shop online was a big part of what Threadless did.
Right. With Threadless, it was more, we have a concept of creating a community, creating our customer base to feel as if they're part of this business, part of what we're doing. And T-shirts really was just the easy, no-brainer thing that, you know, was a commodity that you can sell online.
So the culture was the thing you were selling.
Exactly. So it was, I'd say if you asked me, you know, back then when I was at Threadless, it wasn't a T-shirt company. It was a community of artists. And that's what we were trying to promote and foster.
Threadless has gone in so many different directions. After you left in 2007. They've
right.
even become a bigger, the warehouses in the West Side, much bigger company. But what did you learn from that experience of being in the epicenter of a company that really took off? Threadless is known to be one of the original tech startups in the city. What did you learn from that experience that you take to Porcini?
Well, doing Threadless, we learned a lot of things, positive and, you know, we've had a lot of failures while doing that. And what I think I noticed over the years was that everything that stuck, everything that was successful was based on helping the community, helping the artists, helping them promote themselves, help them, you know, become better artists, help them make money. And that was kind of my lesson to myself is that it's similar to Basecamp. Like Basecamp is software that helps right. other businesses make more money.
It's kind of like a to-do list online, a checklist, if you will, for businesses.
Right. It helps the businesses manage their own business and helps them be more organized, more efficient, and make more money. And so it was more of a selfless ambition to help either other artists or, in this case, for Porcini, other restaurants manage their business and manage making their money and staying profitable and ultimately not going out of business.
How do you balance the need for community, supporting artists, and making money? At the end of the day, Porcini wants to make money.
Right. And for what we're trying to do is, in the early parts of this business, is really listen to our customers. We've been open to the public for our, I could say, public beta since mid-June, so it's only been a few months. And already we have restaurants from coast to coast and on four different continents using it. And so you can really see the difference of how a coffee shop uses it versus a barbecue place in Vietnam that uses it, or the Heritage, you know, as we can see it, I can stand in the kitchen and see how they use it. So it's great to listen to their feedback and see how they're using it, because we can focus on that. You know, it doesn't help us for me to assume what they need. It's great to actually see what they're how they're trying to use the software, or how they're not using the software. If they're not using the software for a certain thing, then maybe I need to tweak how we, you know, develop a certain feature.
The other part of Threadless, which was revolutionary, was customer service. That was a big part of picking the shirt that you wanted, the what was the competition or the different polls and things of that nature. But talk about customer service, because if you are catering or using Porcini as a barbecue place in Vietnam or, you know, in Forest Park or wherever you might be, I would assume that if something goes wrong with the app, it's important for you to be front and center when it comes to customer service. What did you learn from the Threadless experience when it comes to customer service?
Yeah, absolutely. Customer service isn't a way to deal with problems. Customer service is a way to communicate with your customers. And it's a way to keep in touch and let them know that there is someone out there that you can talk to over email, chat, or even on the phone in some cases. And that's very important for us at Porcini. So if anyone emails us, we always respond within, you know, an hour or so, even on the weekends. We want to know what they're thinking, what they want to use it for, what they've stumbled upon, or any issues that they've found. I take a lot of inspiration from Tock, which is another Chicago business that's kind of disrupting the online reservation for restaurants.
Yeah, Nick Kokonis.
Yeah. You could probably ask Nick, and he'd say that Tock is, you know, a certain percentage a software company, but a large percentage a hospitality company. It's really about being there for their customers and listening to them and helping them out. We use Tock at our restaurant, and they have unbelievable customer service. And it's not just great for us because we can have a question answered quickly, but it makes us feel like we're involved in the future of that software, and it makes it feel custom tailored to us, and it just overall better experience.
With Porcini, do you, as the founder of this restaurant app, do you look out 10 years, 15 years? I mean, what's the growth pattern? What do you have to do to hit your marks? Is it we need to be in this many restaurants and we need to have marketing money to get people to know about? What's the game plan looking out 10 years?
Speaking of other lessons learned from Threadless, Threadless was originally a bootstrapped company. We didn't raise money to start that business, and we got to a point where it was making quite a bit of money. We had a good number of employees, never had to raise a single dollar or even spend a single dollar in marketing. And in between Threadless and Porcini, I've had a few other business experiences where we have raised money, where we have relied on marketing dollars. And to me, I just like my original experience from my first business and bootstrapping it and kind of, you know, taking it slow and building it a good solid foundation instead of going quickly and hiring, you know, 20 employees to build something quickly. So we're a small company. We're bootstrapped with Porcini. And we have, you know, we have goals and ambitions, but we really don't have investors or other people breathing down our necks telling us that we have to hit certain metrics at certain times. You know, our focus is on making good software.
You could do this anywhere. You do it in Chicago because you're here and you're obviously the restaurant's here, and Threadless as well, big Chicago company that didn't need to be in Chicago. What is it about this town? What is it about Chicago that keeps you as an entrepreneur here?
I've done business in New York. I've done business in California, and I love Chicago. I think the people in Chicago are great. I think the entrepreneurs, the technology scene here is great. What I like about Chicago is that when you have a conversation with someone, you know the other person's listening, and they're not just waiting for their turn to speak. And so I think it's really great for creating a business and finding business partners and just coming up with good, solid business plans and business ideas rather than a startup. You know, it's not so much, artificial intelligence or chatbots or this and that. That's popular. Let's do it. Let's create a startup. I see this problem in an industry that's relevant to me, and I see an opportunity there. So you're smart. I'm smart. This guy's smart. She's smart. Let's all get together and build a business.
You are, with Threadless, one of the granddaddies of startups, tech startups in Chicago. And before 1871 and all the kind of stuff in between, does it stay that way? Does Chicago still retain its authenticity when it comes to startup companies, the things you're talking about, as more and more entrepreneurs come to this town?
I hope so. I think Chicago has a lot of challenges. There is a big brain drain because it is pretty attractive to a lot of people to go to the coasts. There's a lot of money out there. There's a lot of opportunity out there. And the weather's nice in California. I think Chicago's here to stay, and it's only going to get better. With 1871, that was a huge game changer. You know, I'm looking at Matter in Chicago for other biotech startups. I think will be great for Chicago. I think it's great and only going to get better.
Jacob DeHart is the man behind Porcini, which is a restaurant software that's used for the back end of restaurants, kitchen organizing, menus, schedules, everything that needs to be done to keep a restaurant afloat. He was also the co-founder of Threadless, the t-shirt business, I guess that's what you call it, here in Chicago. Jacob DeHart, thanks for being my guest on the Download on Chicago Business.
Thanks for having me.
It's Download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Well, come be part of the audience and experience your favorite WGN radio podcast live at Chicago Podcast Festival, Saturday, October 7th, the Old Town School of Folk Music. Great school of folk music. So many folk music schools, but Old Town, they take the cake. Over the course of two shows, 7 p.m., 9:30, six podcasts covering everything from music to entertainment, spirituality, current events, and politics. Think, laugh, learn, and discover something new. Tickets are $25 for one show, $40 for both shows. Showtimes are 7 p.m. and 9 p.m. Get to details and the link to buy tickets at WGNradio.com/events. Saturday, October 7th at the Old Town School of Folk Music, 4545 North Lincoln Avenue in Chicago. Tickets and details at WGNradio.com/events. Yeah, that'd be fun, right? To be able to see podcasts. I love it. I love, you know, the podcast, I wouldn't even say resurgence, just surge.
Mm-hmm.
It's awesome to put a festival together to be able to get loyal fans to come out and meet the people and be able to see a live taping.
Yeah, that's great.
It. Yeah.
Peek behind the curtain.
Right. I'll take it. That's a good lineup, too. Those are all great people. Mincing Rascals, Nick DiGiulio, Kelly Leonard, Guth and Hupke.
Oh, it's stacked.
Sound Sessions, and Jen Weigel. That's great. That's a great combo.
I think, and I was talking to Michael Heidemann, you know, he of Sound Sessions, yeah. And Patty Vasquez. I think he said, I think our friend, Show You Suck, is going to be part of that.
Oh, nice.
He's going to be out there with them as well.
Is he going to perform, or is he just talking?
I'm not sure.
Him? Cool. Very cool. It's going to be hard to see the show, and then in the next room, Guitar 101 is going on, and so they're all going, row, row, row your boat, and they're all singing, if I had a hammer.
Yeah, I took many of failed classes in the...
It's a hard, it's a hard, it's a hard. Okay, let's do it again, guys. It's a hard. No.
Every time I would take a lesson, the 3 months was every other word I would say during the class would be ah. Ah.
That should be on the brochure. And if you're available Thursday nights, take ah. Masterclass. Ah. That's hilarious. I love that. The place is great.
Yeah.
Just joking around with them. And they're in a special place because that used to be a library. The old Town School of Folk Music on Lincoln was the public library of Lincoln Square at the time, the old stomping grounds, 1996, 95, maybe 94. You know, when the heat wave was going on, that's where I was at, hanging out. Although the library was closed at that point, but whatever. You get my drift.
Mm-hmm.
I'm OG.
You are.
Old school, yeah. Thank you, Rob. It is the Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. Coming up in the 9 o'clock hour tonight, Pastor Corey Brooks is going to join us in studio. We'll talk about his new project that he is cutting the ribbon on tomorrow, a new center for learning, for, I guess, for employment on the south side in Woodlawn. It's in the old Walgreens at 63rd and King. We'll talk with Pastor Brooks about this. Has been really at the core because, you know, they call him the rooftop pastor. And at the core, what he was trying to do was to raise awareness the idea of all this foreclosed property and find a way to renovate and rehab his neighborhood. And he continues to do that. So we'll talk to him about taking a space of Walgreens at 63rd and King that people were angry they closed. They left the south side of Chicago. Pastor Corey Brooks steps in. So we'll talk with him at 9 o'clock. And then also Nellie Vasquez Roland will join us. She is a homeless advocate. We'll talk with her about the tent cities that were set up in Uptown last week and, of course, taken down and what that means for homelessness and what give us sort of a status update of where we're at. The homeless population 2017, the fall of 2017 here in Chicago. So that's coming up in the 9 o'clock hour. Well, you know the old saying, we laugh to keep from crying. It's a good phrase that gets bandied about when we can't handle what we're dealing with in our personal lives. Well, according to Professor Al Genie, that's exactly what we need. Humor in our lives. Jokes are designed in the human experience to distract and distance, but also designed to connect emotionally or sarcastically. A good joke can change the way we feel, even change us. A bad joke, well, kind of does the same thing. Our resident philosopher Al Genie returns tonight with a new book. It's called The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. Al Genie, of course, a professor of business ethics at Loyola University's Quinlan School of Business and also a resident philosopher here. Congratulations on a great book, Professor. I loved it.
Thank you.
I loved it.
You actually read it.
I did. This I read all the jokes.
This is all jokes. But the jokes are reading there. But I'll tell you one thing, it's not a joke. People just ask me, why have you written this book? I mean, what philosophical plateau are you trying to achieve? Are you trying to unmask and the notion of jokes as weapons made of words to deal with life? No, I want my grandkids to be able to go to college.
That's not in the book. You need that in the book. Right.
We're working the room all week, ladies and gentlemen. But it's, you know, I wrote the book. To tell you the truth, I started writing this book 73 years ago because I had this wonderful opportunity to have Uncle Joe.
Yeah.
I hope everybody has an Uncle Joe, that older male or female, depending on your gender, that you could go to, that you could ask questions of, that would give you the extra $5 or 25 cents, whatever it was, who you got in trouble and you could talk to him first and he would give you good advice, smack you around a little bit if you deserved it. But he was the trustworthy person. But the best part of Uncle Joe is every time I saw him to the week before he died, and he passed about 8 years ago now, which is so sad for me, as in the middle of the embrace, as he was about to kiss me, he would whisper in my ear, did you hear the one about? And then tell me a joke every time. Rarely, if ever, did he repeat himself. And this happened my whole life, so that as I got older, the jokes got a little naughtier. Uncle Joe was not a prude in any way, shape, or form. But in my teenage years, when I was kind of rebellious and pushing back, and Uncle Joe, get close to five. What are you doing? Because it's all in Italian.
Why are you up in my ear? Why are you always telling me jokes? Why are you telling me all these jokes?
Yeah, back off. What's this all about? And he pushed back from me and he said, Alfredo, stupido, if I didn't love you, why would I want to make you laugh? Why would I give you the gift of a joke? Jokes are a tool and a weapon. Be careful how you use them. But remember, you never have enough laughter in life, Alfredo. So, did you hear the one about?
Anyway,
it was great. And this is.
I love that story.
Yeah, it's a true story. It has the advantage of being true. And I've tried to do this with the people I love. Not the way he was able to. He had certain gremlin about him. He could do the faces. He could do the voices. He could do the shtick. He was kind of a tall Mel Brooks. And Mel Brooks was his favorite comic as well. But Uncle Joe, like Mel Brooks, understood that jokes are a defense, a tool, and a weapon against reality. That we needed something to make sense of it because there are so many unanswerables, so many irresolvables, so many unavoidable problems and issues in life, and reason doesn't apply. You know, it's like love. Does reason apply to love? Half of us get in so much trouble in our lives because we're in love and this is not rational, et cetera, et cetera. And so jokes are this wonderful attempt to try to defang the moment, to try to understand the moment. If nothing else, as Groucho Marx said, to have a brief respite, to take a breath and go, okay, let's try this another way.
Well, it's funny, too, because you'll see a ton of people use humor in this way. I mean, yeah. I was just thinking about even with the Kaepernick knee stuff, you'll have the NFL Today joking around about it. The guys before, they always have a comic on before. Yeah. You know, it's part of even things that we don't find necessarily that we think to be funny. What I wanted to ask, though, this is not a book, and this is you go out of your way to say this. This is not a book that is dissecting what makes jokes funny.
Yeah.
And that's something to realize, because that, you know, there's so much that goes in the psychology of what is a joke.
It's
and
too hard. It's an absolute invariable. You could talk about the structure of jokes. Okay, we could talk about, you know, the teller, the tale, the toll, the timing. That's just basic stuff, and we can take that apart a little bit later. But as Ted Cohen said recently, died last year at the University of Chicago in his book on jokes, how do you know it's funny? You know, there's something absolutely elliptical about it. There's something almost mystical about it. And one of the things, you know, is you got to be sharing a culture. You got to have some cultural bond between you. That's why jokes don't work in different languages. That's why jokes don't work in different countries. That's why when I sit down now to watch Saturday Night Live, I don't know what they're talking about, what they're parroting, because they're parroting what this age group has found interesting. But when Bellucci and Aykroyd did it, I got it, because I was part of that crowd. So, but what's funny is it can't be determined, and that people don't get jokes can't be determined, and that many people can't tell jokes. But the saddest is, think about it, this is the saddest thing you can say about a person. She never told a joke. She never got a joke. She never laughed.
Beyond the idea that a joke will make us smile,
yeah,
or make us laugh, or tap into something, there's more, and you talk about this in the book, and you connect with it, the emotional part of joke telling, and the way that it connects us in a way, even as a distraction, even as, like I said, distance from issues. There's something about the human spirit and the way we are as humans that it's almost embedded in our DNA.
I'm not sure I would go that far and bet in the DNA, but as a metaphor, I agree with you. It is in deep inside of us, and every culture has a history of jokes, and we know the most common joke. You know what the most common jokes are? What a surprise! Sex, you know. But of course, every culture has a tradition of jokes, and when it's allowable to tell jokes and not allowable to tell jokes. But I think we need to tell jokes. I think we need to laugh at life, because if we don't laugh at life, we can't deal with it. You know, Joan Rivers said it. She was correct when she said this. She died too soon, stupidly as well. If you could laugh at it, you could live with it. That you could take a pause from it. That you could step away from it. That you can't be beaten down. But we're both parents. And our children have done things you've gone, oh, my God, were they born without brains or what? And you have to either laugh at it or beat them to death. And you can't beat them to death, and it'd be wrong. So you either laugh or you're mad at what does that prove? So you got to laugh with it, or you'll be laughed at by it. And there's a
live with it, right? Professor Al Jeaney is the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. It's just out right now. Let's do this. Let's take a break.
Okay.
We'll come back. We'll continue the conversation at the big table tonight. Professor Al Jeaney, stay with us. It's a download here, 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman with you till 11 o'clock tonight. Professor Al Jeaney, our resident philosopher here on the download, and of course the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago, has written a new book called The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. And this is something, it's so fun, Al, and I love when you come in. The conversations are always great. This is near and dear because we've had conversations about this topic. And I know you've been working on this for a while, because you've always been, every time we say, what else do you want to talk about? You're like, well, I'm working on my humor book. And you're getting great reviews for it. And every NPR station in the world wants to talk to you.
They're very, very nice. They're very, very nice. But I feel like Adlai Stevenson. If the only people who buy it are the people who listen to NPR, I'll be a poor man.
They're like, laughter is laughter with Al Jeaney is here.
And we're wearing sandals and we're having cookies without any fat or sugar in it. Hello. You know, you started to ask me on the break, so let me set this up. So what's the history of it?
Yeah, let's talk about the history. Where's this? Because I kind of mentioned the DNA part, you push back a little bit. But there is evidence in history going back to ancient civilization.
It is a cultural constant, if not a DNA constant. And this is not an anthropology class, so we won't worry about nature or nurture right now. Right. But I think what's amazing to begin with, you know, E.B. White said it best. Humor, analyzing humor and studying humor is like dissecting a frog. Few people are really interested in it, and the frog dies. So, you know, why do it? But I think it's important to see how it came up. And we know 2900 B.C., there is in hieroglyphics, there is a word for laughter and humor that is etched into the stone there. And perhaps the first book is the book of Genesis, when Abraham and Sarah, well into their dotage, I mean, beyond super grandparents. I think if I'm correct, they're like 90 or 95 or something like that. And some angels come to visit them. They think they're angels. And so Sarah makes dinner, but one of the angels is God. And God says to Abraham, and Sarah will be with the child. And Sarah goes, you got to be kidding. You know, we don't even know what I mean. We can't, it's beyond, you know, it's the thing about, and so she starts to laugh. And God says, are you laughing? And God says, no. If you're God and I'm going to have a child, okay. And he gets, you know, God, what a joker. And so they have a child named Isaac. Isaac, which, by the way, from the Hebrew, is laughter. And so you have the beginning. This is the first. Some scholars call this the first sex joke. And it's in the Bible.
It's a good one.
Anything you want in the Bible, yeah. You know, certainly, it's certainly there. But I think there's a long, long history of it. And part of the history we all know is in the Middle Ages in Europe. But in all cultures, across China, India, the Cheyenne, they call them the contrarians. We had this notion of jesters, of court fool, of the court clown. And the jester was able to speak truth to power, but only in his, and it was 99.9% men, and the few women were there dressed, weren't known as women, only when he was in his outfit, and he could speak truth to power. And it seems to be a psychological need of people to be able to be satirical, to be able to be the snappy comment on it, and that the king or the people of power needed some. This became, a sounding block to a certain extent. These people had real power in the Middle Ages.
And they had real jobs.
They had real jobs.
And you talk about it in the book that I forgot which philosopher talked about it, but if there were nine people, one of them was a joke teller.
Right. And that's a philosopher. It's the greatest philosopher I've ever met, Mel Brooks.
Mel Brooks.
Who said every 10 Jews, one had to be a comic.
But my point, and I'm interested in this because when I think of jesters, and I always wonder about this, that they put the little hats on them. And we have this stereotype or the way that we've conceived how jesters were is they were the weird fools, Emo Phillips, if you will.
Right.
Like
Emo
dumbing
Phillips.
Around.
Still.
Right. But the idea being that they were such fools and so silly. And my interpretation from reading the book and understanding a little bit more about it is that it wasn't necessarily that they were fools or silly. They had a role. They had a real role to speak truth to power.
Now, they wore the outfit. Again,
we do that in some weird way for history.
Right. I think they wore the outfit to say, here I am. The comment is here. So it's okay. I'm working here. You know, let me get my line out right now. So as not to confuse it. But it didn't mean they were foolish all the time. They meant they were able to be fool with the language, to fool with the concepts, to trick the king, to be clever, as Beatrice Otto, who wrote the wonderful book on it, said. There were gestures that the king couldn't eat a bite without them being there. They were entertainment. They were also companions because they had total control over them, et cetera, et cetera. But this tradition, which is across culture, suggests this need to look at the other side, that you couldn't look at all these issues. And it really comes out of, when you think about this, that if humor is a sword and a shield, the jester provided that shield maybe for the king or that sword to be aggressive back and forth. But he had to be working there. And the new jester is the new satirist. And we'll make a distinction between old-time business, show business people and the new satirist.
Well, I mean, we see it now. I mean, just watching late-night television and things like that.
And that's all changed for a couple of reasons. Let's come back to that. But I think the fool was there to do something that Nietzsche talked about. Now, let me point this out, and Jerry Seinfeld said it in the Wall Street Journal article this week. He says, I've been trying to develop a joke on Nietzsche, with Nietzsche in it, and I just can't do it. Nietzsche's not a funny guy. You know, he's just, you know, really depressed. Yeah. You know, big, that mustache alone, how did he even speak? You know, it was just ridiculous. But he said, and this is maybe the whole purpose of my book, and I found this quote afterwards, because who wants to spend time reading Nietzsche? He said, we have art in order not to die of the truth. We have humor in order not to die of the truth. And I think we need truth, you know, as this brief respite. And to put the world, to recognize the world as foolish, not just stupid. To recognize that we can't control everything. To recognize that we can play with this a little bit, that we can understand it better. Again, I don't think humor gives us answers. You don't listen to a brilliant satirist.
And I wonder if that's one of the reasons there's so much pushback on comedy today, is that it is truth to power, that it is contrarian.
Yeah.
But more often than not, and Saturday Night Live is a great example of this, where you almost look at Saturday Night Live to, people look at it as almost the gospel, or the idea that they're right. They're right and the president's wrong, or they're right or the person in power is wrong. They're not right. They don't have the answers. Their job is to point out.
That's what the senator says. Now, let's make a couple of distinctions. First of all, let's make very clear. Let's not talk about the politics of Mr. Trump and all that. But clearly, he is a magnet for comedic response. Clearly, his demeanor, his hair, the way he speaks, his issues, he's just a magnet. And the job of the satirist, as Robin Williams said, is to make fun of everything, to rip everything about. But I think satire has gotten more vicious, more insightful, more realistic, because the issues have changed and because comedy has changed. Now, think about this. You're a little young for this, but I remember Saturday Night Live day one, okay? And that's 40-plus years ago. And from day one, by the way, there was a male performer who made fun of the president. And it was Chevy Chase.
Yeah.
Jerry Ford. And then Dan Aykroyd did Jimmy Carter. Make more 20s. You know, when the inflation was going, make more 20s. Print more 20s, boss. You know, that whole routine.
Yeah.
But Saturday Night Live is primarily satirizing popular culture. The focus has not been comedy. However, Baldwin, in winning this award, Baldwin has captured the zeitgeist. I just said zeitgeist. Oh, my goodness. Good in him. I've been reading too much Nietzsche. It has captured the cultural dilemma we're in with this president, and he's got it down to a science. So the president is responding to him.
Yeah.
Think about this. And so they've ratcheted up a level, and then add to that two men and two shows, Bill Maher.
Yeah.
And Jon Stewart and the Daily Show.
We'll talk about that stuff coming up, because I do think that, you know, it's not new. I remember comics being very vicious during George W. Bush's time. Even the comics that were vicious during Monica Lewinsky and the Bill Clinton time. It's not new, but it almost feels like the issues that we'll talk about coming up in the second half here, about the idea of timing, the idea of time, when is too soon, what is too close to the bone when it comes to humor, when does the idea of joy and laughter and a smile on your face actually backfire.
Yeah.
Al Genie, my guest, the importance of being funny, why we need more jokes in our lives. Professor Genie, of course, our Download resident philosopher. He's also professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University, Chicago. We'll take a break. We'll get the news from Rob. We'll come back and continue the conversation. Stay with us.
So this guy's taking a walk one day, just out in a beautiful fall, autumn day. And as he comes by this one house, there's a huge sign. It says, "Talking dog must sell. Will accept any reasonable offer." He says, "Talking dog must sell. This is not possible." So he goes to the front door, knocks on the door, and he said, "Are you the, is that your sign?" He says, "Yeah, yeah." He says, "You really have a talking dog?" "Yep." "And you want to sell it?" He says, "Yep." "Can I see him?" He says, "Yeah, come on in." So he goes in, and in the living room, there's this lovely golden retriever sitting there. And the guy says, go ahead, talk to him. He says, "All right." So he asks the dog, he says, "So tell me something about yourself." Dog looks up and very clearly says, "Well, I was 8 years in the United States Army, and I had three deployments in Afghanistan. And then I was wounded, unfortunately, but a minor wound. But nevertheless, I had to go to Germany. And when I was in Germany, I got interested in skiing. So then I trained for the Alps, ski patrol. And that was really, really interesting. But again, I blew the black knee out. And so I resigned from the military. And so I'm kind of limited now and really on retirement. And now I've kind of pulled back a little bit. I go to the library in the morning to help the senior citizens. And then just, you know, kind of relax the rest of the day." The guy looks at this dog and says, "This is amazing. This is wonderful." Says, "Why would you ever want to sell such a great animal like that?" And the owner looks at him and points his finger and says, "Because he's a damn liar. He's never done any of that." Thank you, ladies and gentlemen. I'm working the room all evening.
Professor Al Genie, my guest tonight, the author of The Importance of Being Funny, Why We Need More Jokes in Our Lives. That's a good one. He is, of course, the Download's resident philosopher and the professor of business ethics at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University of Chicago. We're talking about jokes and humor. That's a great joke.
I read
that one last night to my son, and it took him a while to figure out what was happening there. And But there is something great about being able to not only tell the story about why we need humor in our lives, but to be able to express it and articulate it in the book by giving examples.
Yeah, I had to tell jokes. I mean, it's like... to write about humor is like reading pornography without pictures. It doesn't work for me. I mean, you know, and insert A and B as often as possible whenever desired. That nothing. It leaves me with absolutely nothing. So I never liked Playboy magazine. You know, one ugly naked woman was much better than the best Playboy model. It just seemed absolutely, and that's a terrible thing. There's no such thing as an ugly woman. But I mean by that, there's something, you know, it's abstract. And I think when you talk about humor, there is something, it's wrong about, you know, in some sense, talking about humor is an oxymoron. How is that really possible? Right. When you talk about it, you break it up and you dissect it.
You put it under a microscope. You can't do it.
It's a Heisenberg effect. Yeah. Absolutely. As soon as you put it under a microscope, it changes it. You're a comic. You've done comedy for years. I've seen your work. And good luck on that. Anyway. I'm sorry.
That's good.
I've known you for too long. Forgive me. But you know, I think that, you know, Mark Twain said it best of all. That humor is an assault against reality, and it allows us, you know, and it allows nothing to stand to destroy us. And I think we need it. And we were talking in the break about what does humor do between individuals? Well, you know, for me, besides humor being a defense mechanism that you're laughing at the absurdity, you're laughing at, because think about the jokes, death, sex, marriage,
politics.
Children, politics.
Yeah.
They're a way to whistle in the dark. They're a way to laugh at the irresolvable in life. But I think humor also is a gift we give to somebody. It's a mitzvah, if you will. So when I meet you, I offer a joke. I'm trying to find out, as Ted Cohen said, do you think like me? Do you think that was funny? And if you thought that was funny, do you like me for knowing that I know this joke and that I gave it to you? And so
it's part of our personality. Right.
And so the smile. But the danger is being the buffoon. And my family tells me I sometimes skate too close to this. That is to always be telling jokes, to never have a serious moment, to be telling also bad jokes. I mean, I think people accept clever buffoons over dullard buffoons. And I think that becomes excessive. When a person cannot have a serious conversation about anything,
yeah, that's trouble.
That's excessive.
Okay.
But when you don't laugh at
That's exactly what I was going to say. I mean, because for all that being said, and we can get into bad jokes and people tell bad jokes and nasty jokes and blue humor, but there's also this aspect of when people don't accept a joke. You tell a joke and they refuse to react, whether it's good or bad. They use it almost as a defense mechanism themselves. They are not interested whatsoever in this connection. What is that? What is that between humans?
There are two things, and you're forgetting one of them. Maybe they didn't get the joke, and that's problematic. So you tell this, I think, brilliant joke to your son, and he goes, I don't plan to get that, Dad. And so when you diagram them, they're not funny.
Right.
You know that, right? You've got to say, well, this is funny because Proposition A really reflects Proposition B, which leads to Proposition C. Boom, the joke is dead. But when you think it's funny or recognize it as a joke, but I'm telling it to you, you're saying, I don't like you. I won't accept you. I don't want to be your friend. And you know, in Inuit, to make love is to laugh. And to laugh with a friend is a gift that you extend. And even the sharing it, in some Inuit tribes, monogamy wasn't de rigueur. And so to love to a friend's wife was a gift you gave to someone. That's all I know.
This took a dark turn.
This took a dark turn. But think of laughter as a gift.
Yeah.
And so when you reject that gift,
you're giving it back.
You reject me.
And
you've been a comic. You've been on stage.
Yeah. No. That happens.
When you're out there giving your best lines, and the only thing you hear is the glass ice in the glass.
No, I mean, and I'm sophisticated enough to understand that is a part of how I tell the joke, and I make that, and there are some times when I don't tell it the right way or the content is not there, and I understand that, and I understand missing that connection.
Right.
It is something to me, this idea that we have almost created radar, sophisticated radar, to be part of our personality. We think certain things are funny and certain things aren't. We as human beings will create a sophisticated palate to be like, I'm not going to laugh at that dog joke.
Right.
I don't, it's beneath me.
Right.
Is that just when we use it as part of our personality to say how we collect and how we connect with humor is also part of it.
But you said it's a sophisticated palate. Somebody asked, I opened a show recently in an East Coast NPR station, and he said, let me tell you the story about David Sedaris, which I think is the funniest joke ever, and about, you know, and it was a scatology joke. It was about discussing bowel movement. And he said, and you don't mention scatology at all in your book. And I said, because I'm not a child. I don't want to talk about scatology. Scatology, what children said to, you know, said, do you know the difference between living room drapes and toilet paper? No. Well, my mommy says you can't come to our house. Ha, 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 ha. I don't care about, I don't like fart jokes. I don't like da, 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 da jokes. And so I don't like demeaning jokes. I don't like da da da. And so I think we have a different palette, and the type of joke you tell says something. I find it absolutely fascinating that Andrew K. Dice has a show on right now that's rather successful, even if it's on cable.
It's called Dice. Yeah.
And Dice, and he's actually making fun of himself.
Yeah.
And that's why it's funny. But I don't like him as a performer. I think he's over the top. I'll give you another example. The reigning princess of comedy is Amy Schumer. I think she's a brilliant writer. I think she's a great comedic actor. I saw her 3 times live, and I want to tell you, I don't want to know anything more about her body. I want her to do something else.
She needs new material.
She needs new material.
Well, I don't know. There's something about this when you think about comedy and the sophisticated palette that we're talking about. You obviously are getting closer and closer to the third rail, which is jokes about race, jokes about sex, jokes about religion, politics. We see more and more people getting in trouble for telling these jokes, forwarding emails, doing things where they're trying to, at the end of the day, Al, and this is, I guess, you know, I don't want to be the apologist for people who are making those jokes, but they are, in their way, following the rules that are set up in your book about connections. They're trying to emotionally connect or trying to bring joy to someone's life, even if it's in that moment they're putting someone else down.
Except you've forgotten the golden rule, and you know the golden rule of real estate. Tell me the 3 rules of real estate.
Location. Right.
Three rules of comedy. Audience. Do you tell your mother a sex joke? You better not, unless it's so elliptical that it's only the sex part is only on the fringes. Do you tell your son a naughty sexual joke? Probably not. Not yet. And so I think that you got to remember the audience. And the reality is, and I think this is really important to understand, Justin, is that misogynist jokes, racial jokes, anti-Semite jokes, so on and so forth, pro-Nazi jokes really can be funny. The meter of them are funny, but do you tell them? Is it appropriate? So the tale that you're telling, it's about timing. When do you tell a joke? Frankly, I just came back, as you know, or this summer I spent in Africa for a month in Africa, and we wound up in Rwanda to climb with the gorillas, an amazing experience. I will never tell a Rwanda genocide joke. I've never told an AIDS joke. I'm never going to tell a 911 joke. I'm never going to tell, you know, I've told some cancer jokes, but only happy resolve cancer jokes, but they're so tricky that I'm afraid of them.
But a lot of times,
you've got to be very careful.
Yeah, I understand that, but I have laughed at bad jokes.
That's right.
I've laughed at jokes that were at the expense a lot of the topics that you just mentioned.
Because they're funny. Right. They're actually funny. Yeah. But should you tell them? And in telling them, here's my point. In telling an unethical joke, let's just call it an unethical joke, whether it's a misogynist joke or whether it's a racial joke, unethical joke, you are, in the very least, perpetuating the myth that joke embodies.
Yeah.
And so should we do that? Should we tell certain kinds of jokes about slavery,
ethnicities,
and it really is difficult. That doesn't mean there are not ethnic jokes that are just absolutely charming that people make fun of. And I'll tell you one ethnic joke. A racial or ethnic joke rather than a racial joke that everybody accepts, and the people who tell them are multimillionaires, it's redneck jokes. And you know why? Because when he says, hey, if you go to family picnics to pick up girls, you're probably a redneck. If you and your dad walk to school because you and your dad are in the same class, you're probably a redneck. And I've forgotten his name right now. And
Foxworthy.
Right? Absolutely.
Right. Foxworthy,
he's worth
Jeff Foxworthy.
Over $170 million, he said. Best-selling books, best-selling.
And why? Audience.
Because there are no people who register themselves as rednecks. They think that there's something else.
And this is a big part. You see it with black comics. See it with ethnic comics where they will tell jokes that are specific to their area and they get it and nobody else gets it and they make millions.
They make millions. Yeah. And Garrison Keillor used to tell the Ole and Lena jokes. And I just love some of the Ole and Lena jokes.
Another great example.
And
right?
he said... Because they're making fun of an issue there. They speak Scandish or whatever, Scandinavian issues. They're still here. They've been here for 50 years, but they're still speaking it that way. And he said, these are not simple people. They're not simpletons. They have simple lives. It's Ole's dying. And he says, is my wife here? He says, yeah, Ole, I'm here. I'll give you the better one. Ole and Lena have been married 25 years. They have a big, big, big party. Everybody leaves. And when everybody leaves, Lena smacks Ole in the, just knocks him down and says, what's that for? And he says, that's for 25 years of bad sex. And okay. So he gets up, thinks about it a minute, and goes over to Lena, knocks her down with a blow. And he says, what's that for? He says, that's for knowing the difference between the two. You know, I mean, but yeah. That's an ethnic joke, but it's an ethnic joke where they're making fun of themselves. Yeah. It's created by themselves.
And again, we're getting further into the idea of dissecting right. what works, what doesn't work in comedy. What I want to ask about as we get close to wrapping up here is when people take it seriously, when people are defensive, that they are hurt personally by jokes. You see this with family. I find myself, my wife and my son, they'll get on a roll. And it'll be Justin bashing for 20 minutes, and I get a little huff.
Yeah.
I get a huff. I'm like, it went away from smile on my face. Now I've got my arms, you know, turning the TV up and not listening. I mean, talk about that human experience. That it's not a given that humor is an entryway into laughter, smiles, and
no,
positivity.
It's not. Again, it is about the teller, the person telling it, the tale, who you're telling to, and the timing. All these things are critical. And, you know, it's what Mark, here, maybe I can answer it with a Mark Twain quote. And even if it, you know, I've learned that when I'm stumped and I think
just go to Mark Twain quote.
I just say, Mark Twain said, but this is, he actually said this. He said, never enter a funeral telling a joke and laughing. But never leave the funeral without sharing a joke about the departed. It's the appropriateness of the joke and the time. It's knowing when to tell the joke. My Uncle Joe knew how to break the ice with me, was giving me this gift. But Uncle Joe, you know, it's knowing the tempo of things. And I think it is about, you've been a comic. You know it's timing, timing, timing. And let me give you an experience from my real life that also motivated this. I've been playing handball essentially with the same general group of guys for about 40 years plus. And when we were in our late 40s, so we're still, you know, we're still thinking we're macho guys, we're playing handball. Suddenly, they're screaming in the next court, and they're yelling, Doc, Doc, come over, quick, quick. And everyone's called me Doc for years. They don't know if I'm a dentist, a surgeon, or a professor. So I run over with my friends, and this guy's on the floor, and he's clearly had a heart attack. In fact, he's dead already. He's blue on the ground. Wound up in the autopsy that he blew out an aorta, and he was dead before he hit the ground. And I'm giving him CPR, and I'm into the rhythm. We're trying, bleeding in his mouth, doing the whole thing. They call the med people in, and they say, no, keep going. You've got the rhythm going. Oh. 15 minutes go by. They finally says, no, he's dead. He's gone. That room was filled up with about 20 guys, and the stench of their fear you could cut with a knife. So I finally looked up and says, I don't think any of you guys will mind if I take his gloves now, do you?
Jeez.
He won't be using them this week. You know,
did anyone laugh?
Everyone did.
Everyone
laughed.
Jeez.
And it broke the ice.
Yeah.
But would you tell that joke?
I'm waiting for you to get up and open the dice with these jokes.
No. But think about that. It's the right time, the right place.
Yeah.
And that is when humor is a sword or a shield. But this is a horrible situation. We've done everything right. We can to save this man. We've given him due respect and due diligence. And it was horrible in there. It was horrible in there and a way to break the ice. But in the end, I think what we're really saying, both of us, is humor is more than foolish fun. Humor is a way of dealing with life when we don't have any other alternatives, and maybe a better way than some of the alternatives.
There you go. The importance of being funny. Why we need more jokes in our lives. A new book from Al Jeaney, the resident philosopher here on The Download, also a business ethics professor at the Quinlan School of Business at Loyola University Chicago, joins us once a month here on The Download. Al, great to see you.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Always fun to have Al Jeaney in studio, right? Good combo. Thanks for all the texts, too. I realized a lot of people were texting in. They had questions. But I missed it because I was so engrossed. Is there a joke that's not demeaning to somebody, either the teller or the listener? 630 says, Ole and Lena arrived 2 weeks later than expected in Vegas. When asked what took them so long, they replied, we saw signs all along the highway that said clean restrooms, so we did. Good stuff. All right, coming up, 9 o'clock hour, we're paying close attention to the game out in St. Louis. The Chicago Cubs down 2 to the Cardinals. The Cardinals leading right now 5-3 in the fourth inning. But, you know, the Cardinals had a start in this game. They took the lead, and the Cubs have been clawing back. So if they can just unfortunately, not a great showing for Jake Arrieta, who's already been yanked. On the other side, not getting any help from the good old Milwaukee Brewers as they are winning their game 6-3 in the sixth inning. So if these two things stay the same, we'll be doing this again tomorrow. It's like, all right. It's awesome.
Leave it to the Cubs to not make it easy.
Yeah, I guess if we want to set the example, right? We want to be the example to Chicago. Say it's not a big deal. They won the division. They're going to win. The Central, come on. They're going to win that division, right? And that's supposed to be, I mean, I get it. I'm a kid. I'm a Chicago kid. 1984, when you got down to that magic number and who was up at the plate? Orsulik? Who was the guy that Sutcliffe struck out that was a phantom strike that they called and everyone jumped and went crazy? And that shot we've seen so many times. And it was like, that was a moment of like, that's all we have. They didn't win. That's all we had.
Mm-hmm.
Same with 89. That's all we had. You know, you look back on history, like they don't win. But now they've won. And it changes. It's so interesting to me, the philosophy, like the psychology has changed. Once they've won the World Series, the clinching the division, eh.
I have to say that I've brought this up to my wife where I am not quite as nervous as I would have been had they not won the World Series last year. I'm still nervous. Like, I'm still thinking, like, oh man, you know, they could lose the last five games and the Brewers could sweep and look at this and we're fine. Oh, it's still behind me, but I'm not totally pacing every single time that I'm watching the Cubs, only half pacing.
I like your patience though, Pete. You are growing with the team. You're changing the psyche of the Chicago Cubs fan and the Chicago Cubs nation.
Exactly.
We're no longer worried about the fourth inning. You're not having that strange feeling where you're like, oh, this is all going to go bad. I know it's going to go bad. Right, it always goes bad. It doesn't. You won the World Series. You actually went in the opposite direction. You were losing in Game 7. You know, you got a rain delay. Like, all of that wipes out years and years of, oh, this is so Cub. So here we are at a great moment where the Chicago Cubs could clinch tonight, but maybe they don't. Maybe they do it tomorrow night. And it doesn't really matter because we're really looking to next week when they take on the Washington Nationals. I will not accept or entertain a narrative in which they blow this because they're not going to.
Okay.
There's just no – it's one game. It's a one game.
But I want them to clinch, though. I need the clinch before I can feel totally at ease. I can say, like, yeah, you know, they got this in the bag. But there's something about actually clinching.
I'm more worried about my fantasy baseball championship
in the party room.
than the Cubs. Cubs are going to clinch me. Not sure. It's tight.
Four games left? 4 days left?
What is it? Yeah, we play till Sunday. And I'm in the championship, and it is tied. We're 14-category league, 7-7. And it's a lot of what's happening to me tonight is a lot of red X's are next to the players saying, well, that's it for the season.
Oh, no.
That guy was hurt, and now, you know what? Why even play anymore? Because our Baltimore Orioles were out of it. You know, and you're like, what? Play for me!
Yeah.
Play for
Don't
the
they
fantasy
know?
Baseball
they
team.
Know
they're
what's
still
going
playing.
On.
Yeah. Like they just said, like Daniel Murphy, the second baseman for the Nationals, he just sat out two games in a row. They're resting him for the playoffs, but it's like, nah, get him in the game. All right. Coming up, Corey Brooks, Pastor Corey Brooks. We'll also talk with Nelly Vasquez Roland about homelessness. And we'll see. We'll either clinch or we'll play the worst. Coming up here in the 10 o'clock hour. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here at 720 WGN. I'm Justin Kaufman. As we watch the Cubs game closely, as the Cubs right now in the top of the fifth, threatening again, down 5-3 right now, but they're threatening to put another on the board and get this one close tonight. A win will clinch the NL Central. Chicago Cubs and the St. Louis Cardinals right now. We're paying attention to that game, and we will bring you, of course, post-game and celebratory radio. If they win. If they don't, we'll play the worst. 312-981-7200. Well, tomorrow, business and community leaders, alongside the governor of the state of Illinois, will break ground on a new training facility in the Southside neighborhood of Woodlawn. It's the work of Project Hood, which is led by Chicago pastor Corey Brooks. Brooks, who was just on the show recently to talk of the need for more community development, has made a name for himself in trying to buy up or build or renovate property in poverty-stricken neighborhoods. Well, he's putting his money where his mouth is. The Leadership and Economic Opportunity Center will feature co-working spaces, training in specific trades, and youth mentoring programs. It's opening where the Walgreens once stood, right there at 63rd and King, which closed last year amid protests from Woodlawn residents who worried about the lack of pharmacy in the area, as well as the vacancy being an eyesore in the neighborhood. Pastor Corey Brooks in studio tonight to preview the ribbon cutting, which will be tomorrow. Pastor Brooks, good to see you.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on your show.
All right, so let's talk about this. This is a huge opportunity. I mean, it's an opportunity center, but it's a huge opportunity for residents of Woodlawn. Where does this where did this come from?
Well, you know, it came from the fact that Walgreens was going out of business, and they decided that they wanted to do something productive for the community since they were leaving, and they gave us the building for the duration of their lease to do something positive for the community. So we decided to eventually we're going to have a community center, but why not start now? Why not start trying to help people build businesses? Why not start trying to help people get into construction? Why not start turning the tide on the violence in our neighborhood? So that's the reason why we're doing this. As this center, and we're really excited about it.
I mean, tomorrow will be the ribbon cutting. Like I said, Governor Rauner will be there. You know, talk about that, the experience and the emotion that goes into cutting a ribbon on the center. That's something that I know we've talked about it before, but this is really sort of been your life's work outside of the church.
Absolutely. You know, I make no doubt about it. I am very, very excited about it. It's been a long, hard journey. I really thought about it today when we were putting some of the last fixtures in. And I said, you know, it's been about 5 years that I've been trying to get this center up. And it's been 5 years of positive and negative, 5 years of encouragement and criticism. But it's been worth it all. And so tomorrow is a combination of hard work and dedication and determination by just not me, but a lot of people, the people at our church and New Beginnings Church and people in our community who have faithfully stood behind what we're attempting to do. And so I'm really excited about tomorrow. And I can't wait to celebrate.
The Leadership and Economic Opportunity Center, what's the need? You know, because you mentioned you kind of talked about violence right at the beginning there, but what's the need that what niche is it filling? Mm-hmm. I mean, a lot you talk about trades, and we used to get trades skills in CPS and other places. Talk about jobs and job training. What is this need? Or how are you filling this need?
You know, we talk about the fact that we believe that jobs trump violence, that if we want to get rid of some of the violence in our neighborhood, we have to create an economic engine. We have to create entrepreneurs. We cannot continue to wait for people to come into our neighborhood and save us from ourselves. We have to make up in our own minds to form our own destiny and do something about the challenges that we're confronting with every single day. So instead of waiting on government or waiting on other people, we've decided that, listen, we can do this, we can meet this challenge, and we can help change lives. We can help direct the situation that we're facing in order that people can have a better life. So let's create these entrepreneurs. Let's create these companies. Why can't we do something positive to turn the tide on the violence? And that's exactly what we're going to do.
Paint a picture of Woodlawn, because Woodlawn in the last couple of years has seen a surge of projects like this. Mm-hmm. and other community projects that have raised awareness and involvement, if you will. Paint a picture of Woodlawn for us right now.
You know, I talk about how Chicago, people call it the tale of two cities. You have it, the haves and the have-nots. Well, Woodlawn is the same way. It's the tale of two Woodlawns, that there are people in Woodlawn who do great, who are prospering, and they have the middle-income families, and they're doing really good. Their educational levels are a little higher than the norm. But there is also a very large population of people who don't have, a very large population of people who don't have education, don't have economic means, and nor do they have the wherewithal to turn things around. And so that's the group that we're after, mm-hmm. the group that have that lacks, the group that needs a helping hand, not a handout, but a help up. And that's what we're reaching out to. And that's the part of Woodlawn that we're targeting. That's the part of Woodlawn that we're going to turn around.
as a pastor, I would assume that there is some conflict in that, in the idea of trying to serve all of a community when you have the haves and the have-nots, yeah. Even in a micro community. We talk about everything we see in this country, we see in this world,
yeah.
We see in Woodlawn as well.
Absolutely.
Does that make it difficult as one of the community leaders, being a man of faith, to approach the job and to be able to do these kind of things?
You know, it does make it difficult, but I also understand that there are some people who are not just down and out. There are some up and outs, too. There are some people who are educated, some people who have economic wherewithal, and they're just as bad heart-wise sometimes as those who don't have. And so as a pastor, my job is to minister to everyone, and I really want to try to do that as best as I possibly can. Every family needs someone to minister to them. But there are times when there are certain parts of the body that has an ailment that needs to be taken care of. And so you have to have a specialty. And so that's the area that we were called to specialize, yeah. And help that group. And that's what we really want to do.
Before I get back to the center, it is interesting, because do you have, when even with New Beginnings, mm-hmm. and the parishioners that come out to the church,
yeah.
and you have people of different means and different levels of life, whether it be, like you said, people who have the haves and the have nots, if mm-hmm. you will. When you're talking to the haves, do they recognize the same issues that are happening on the south side, that are they sort of like not in my backyard, even though they're part of the community?
Yeah. You know, sometimes people who have, unfortunately, can have that attitude and that mindset that, you know, I don't want anything to do with that. And sometimes we become desensitized, and sometimes we become blind to the needs of others, and it causes us to be less compassionate. But there are people who I know and who are in our neighborhood and outside of our neighborhood who have means, and they're very compassionate, and they're helping us, matter of fact. And so I've seen both sides. I've seen people who don't have anything who don't care. I've seen people who have a lot and they don't care, but I've also seen the other side. There are people who don't have anything and they care a whole lot. They've got a lot of compassion, and there are a lot of people who have means and money and they have compassion to help organizations like ours. And so one of the reasons why we're able to do the things that we're able to do is because there are some compassionate people, some people who have means and money, and they bring those resources to help us meet needs, and we appreciate it.
In your position, especially with the Leadership and Economic Opportunity Center, mm-hmm. What's the goal? What are you setting out? What are the benchmarks for you? What's success for this center?
Success for us looks like helping people get jobs. That's the first thing. You know, when you're looking at 17% to 18%, and sometimes even higher in the Woodlawn area in unemployment, we've got to do everything we can to bring that number down. So if we can help people create jobs, that's a win. If we can help people to start businesses, one of the things that we lack on the south side of Chicago and in the Woodlawn area, specifically African-American business owners are not there. So if we can increase the African-American business ownership and create companies, that's a win also. If we can teach people construction and get guns out of their hands and give them hammers and teach them how to go from the block to the boardroom, every person that we do that for, every person that we get out the streets, every person that we help them to take care of their family, that is a win. And so we're just going to keep chalking it up, and one by one try to change things.
Do you get discouraged or dissuaded when the public I don't want to say stops paying attention, but gets distracted by other issues? I mean, we've seen with violence in Chicago, the numbers are staggering. They're worse this year than they were last year. Last year we were talking there was an anomaly, right? That was the idea, that this was a blip. Do you get frustrated as a community leader who continues to make strides in your community that because of national stories, other stories in the city, violence has become the norm and a story that doesn't necessarily spring people to action?
Yeah, absolutely. It does get frustrating, especially when you're a person like me that feels called to do something about the violence. You want everybody to do something about the violence. But I know we live in a world where individuals have other interests and other things that they're gifted to do. And so I just try to keep myself focused on the fact that I cannot expect everyone to feel the way that I feel. I only need to do and be responsible for the things that I can be responsible for. So I try to do that as much as possible, just stay focused and stay attentive to what I'm supposed to do. But there are times as a leader that you want other people to buy in, and when they don't, it frustrates you a little bit. But the way you get out of that is to just continually stay focused on what your assignment is.
One of the things that's great about this project is that it isn't a form of Walgreens. I mean, mm-hmm. they're giving you the lease until it runs out. But, I mean, There's a lot of businesses in Chicago, not just in Woodlawn, but other right. neighborhoods, where you do see they run out of gas, they leave, they create vacant spaces. Do you see this as a trend? Is this a possible way to think outside the box and be creative about some of the spaces that are eyesores, that sort of are, I don't even, like benchmarks for communities where you're like, oh, this may be a poor community because this building is not being used. Mm-hmm. Do you see opportunities for this kind of stuff in spaces?
Absolutely. I think what we're trying to do and what we're attempting to do, we would love for it to become a model. That's why we're doing it. We believe that we have a solution to help solve some of the violence in these inner city areas, in these impoverished areas. And we believe we have a model that can work. And we want to do everything we can to make it work so that we can take not just this on the south side, but take it on the west side as well. And then hopefully outside of Chicago into some of these other areas like St. Louis and Baltimore and New Orleans, where they're experiencing some of the same type of violence. But we're going to do everything we can first to get the Woodlawn site going and get it going strong. And then we want to see if we can make this model work across America. And if we can have companies to give us the properties that they're leaving and partner with us, I think that's a great social responsibility thing to do.
For you, how do you get butts in seats? How do you get the kids, like you said, to put a gun down and pick up a hammer? What is it that you can offer to them to say, hey, get off the street? And it's lucrative. I mean, let's be honest. Sometimes when you're in the gangbanging trade, it's lucrative. How do you get people out of those situations and into your center?
Two things. One, you have to produce. You have to produce stories. You have to get individuals and produce, and you have to allow them to tell the story on how they're succeeding. And once they begin to tell the story of how they're succeeding, how their life has been changed, others begin to buy into it. The second thing you have to do is you just got to continually cast vision. There are people out there that want something different. There are guys who are on the blocks, on corners, who don't want to be there. And a lot of times people think that just because a person's on the block and they're on the corner, or they're selling drugs or carrying a gun, that that's what they want to do. No, that's not always the case. There are individuals who want to change. They just don't know how to change. And so when they have people come alongside to help them and to assist them to help figure your life out, that's how you change the tide. And that's exactly what we're going to do. We're going to reach those individuals who are ready for a change.
Pastor Corey Brooks in studio tonight, the Leadership and Economic Opportunity Center, which will feature co-working spaces, training in specific trades, youth mentoring programs, is open. They're cutting the ribbon tomorrow. There's a big press conference.
11:30.
The governor will be there, other business and community leaders in the Woodlawn neighborhood, 63rd and King, the former Walgreens. Pastor Corey Brooks, always a pleasure to see you. Thanks for coming in and talking about this. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Good luck to Pastor Brooks and bringing the Learning and Economic Leadership and Economic Opportunity Center to Woodlawn. Woodlawn is so interesting. It's an interesting neighborhood just west of Hyde Park and the south side of Chicago, really in the heart of the south side of Chicago. But I love the concept that if businesses pull out, and that happens a lot, that's just the way economics work, capitalism works. A lot of companies will move on from a space. And a lot of times those buildings just sit there as anchors and reminders of what was once was, you know? So if you can get in there and be creative, and in this case, it looks like Walgreens is helping out in that regard, I think it's a good move. And what I love about it is it is a plan. We talk so much on this program about the ills and what's happening in society and also what's happening in Chicago on the south and west sides. And yet we always talk about what's the plan. What is the plan to curb violence? What are we doing here? The mayor gives lip service. The governor gives lip service. The people running for governor are going to give lip service. But Pastor Corey Brooks, regardless of politics, and second time he's been in here where we're talking about, he has a plan to bring economic development. He's not waiting for the government. He's going in to try and make it happen. I'm not sure it's going to work. Not sure that you'll see any sort of change, but gosh darn it, it's a step in one direction. And I think that far too often we get caught in this sort of loop, right? This collective loop of that won't work. Oh, that won't work. That won't work. Well, I'll tweet about it. Just seems to be it. So I give credit to Pastor Brooks. We'll see if this makes any difference. And if it doesn't, then it won't work, right? All right, coming up, let's talk about the north side of Chicago, Uptown. what a story last week. We saw the 10 cities by court order. And if you're not familiar with the tent cities, they were tents set up by the homeless this summer under the viaduct at Wilson and Lawrence, both Lakeshore Drive. And they lived there, found a way to create a community, and it became an issue in that community in Uptown. There was a lot of residents who said they didn't want it. There were residents that said this was really because affordable housing has changed, options have changed in Uptown. And at the end of the day, they need to fix the highway. Lakeshore Drive needs repair. Court order comes in, wipes out all the tents without a plan to really replace it. Essentially, the plight of the homeless in Chicago. Go somewhere where we can't see you, and we'll figure it out at a different point, but not right now. So we're going to talk about that coming up in the 9:30 segment here. Nellie... is back in studio. Nellie Vasquez, great to have her back, and I'm excited to talk with her. She was on before, and we really had a great conversation about the homeless population and the homeless issues they're facing. She's a safe haven, great organization. So she's coming up at 9:30. We'll talk about what we're not getting, what we're missing with the story about the tent cities up in Uptown. Stay with us. Thanks, Rob. It's Download here, 720 WGN. We're paying attention to that Cubs game. Unfortunately, the St. Louis Cardinals have opened up a 6-3 lead in the bottom of the sixth inning. Also out in Milwaukee up north, the Milwaukee Brewers have a 7-5 lead in the eighth inning. So as you know, if the Milwaukee Brewers lose, the Cubs win. That's the back into it kind of clinch. We don't like that. We want the more defiant, heroic, beat the Cardinals in the in the final inning kind of thing. But right now, the Cardinals leading the Cubs in the sixth inning, 6-3, and the Brewers winning, of course, in the eighth inning as well. So we'll keep you up to date on those stories. But as of right now, we'll continue with the Download. Last week, this is one that I have to say I had a hard time when I was reading about it, understanding it. And it was one of those that I feel like almost in my way of being a talk show host, I didn't understand it. So I said, all right, I don't need to talk about it. I don't need to figure out what's happening with these tent cities in Uptown. So I'll just kind of skip it and ignore it. And over time, reading and kind of gnawing at the back of my mind, I said, you know what? There is something to this story, and I'd love to talk about it. Last week, the homeless living in tents under Lakeshore Drive at Wilson and Lawrence in the Uptown neighborhood were forced to fold up their tents for a construction project. This was a court order, and police arrived to help usher the homeless out and use force if necessary. It wasn't necessary, but many protesters came out to support the tent dwellers, and some of the homeless spread out to a neighboring park or the other surrounding areas, but they were ushered out of those areas as well. So where did they go? The story has two sides, one that tells the story of squatters who took up a legal residency in a Chicago neighborhood, and the other of a growing population of people without homes, forced to live on the street, in shelters, and under expressways like Lakeshore Drive or the Kennedy. Did last week's move by the city solve the problem of homelessness? No. If anything, it reminded us that there's still a huge humanitarian problem in the city that we live in, that we call home, the city of Chicago. Tonight, we talk about the homeless population, how they're faring in late 2017 with Nellie Vasquez-Roland. She is the president of Safe Haven Foundation. And great to have you back in the conversation when you had your run back this summer. And it's great to have you back. Nellie, thanks for being here.
Well, thanks for having me back, Justin. It's exciting to be able to continue that conversation we started back in July.
Yeah, and I thought about that conversation when I saw the tent. And we're really about trying to understand better the homeless population in the city of Chicago and the surrounding area. This issue with tents, and this is one, I think this is why it got complicated for me, was that it's not unique to Chicago. If you go out to California, to downtown Los Angeles, to San Diego, to San Francisco in certain points, this has become almost the norm in which street living has kind of materialized. And we've seen it over and over. In downtown Los Angeles, they've created a city. There's a whole city of tents that essentially house the homeless. So this isn't a new concept. It may be new to Chicago, but this is something that seems to be the way of 2017 when it comes to homeless population.
Yeah. And, you know, I think that really stems from a lot of people seeing the homeless and feeling frustrated, not knowing what to do. And the solution that seems like an easy, quick fix is to really go out and buy them a tent, right? So it's not like they're new, you know. It's just that now they're more visible because they have, you know, colorful tents that they live in. And, you know, that is the, you know, solution that a lot of people feel is better than having them be on the streets. So if you recall the last time I was here, we did that 5K run, and we did it right on Montrose Harbor, which is right down the street right from where that viaduct that you just referred to is located. And we did it there for a reason, because that is where those tent cities are popping up. And what we wanted to do in doing that 5K run at Montrose Harbor, which, by the way, was phenomenal, and we're going to do it again there next year, is the fact that, you know, we wanted to bring to the community all sides of the debate the idea that there is a place that people can go to when they're homeless, when they're in crisis, when they think they're about to be homeless, and they can actually get a roof over their head, three meals a day, and access to a whole host of services that are going to help them.
When construction forces a tent city to fold up, and when this issue becomes prevalent to society, meaning it's in the papers and we're paying, if you don't live in Uptown or you don't go through, you know, that doesn't, you don't take that part of Lakeshore Drive or that commute, you may not know it exists, right? And maybe you come in from the suburbs and you take 90 and you go all the way in, but you're not underneath to see the viaducts that are underneath there. There will be homeless populations living in there. When it becomes evident that this is happening, does it change the way people look at homeless? Do we look at it and say, huh, I didn't know that was happening. That's good. That's bad. That's not how I thought this issue was playing out. I mean, does it change the perceptions of people when things like this tent city segment or news story kind of pop up?
Well, you know, I don't know. But I think people get a sense of actually a little peace of mind knowing that at least they've got a tent, as opposed to being exposed to the elements. And the other day, I just took the tour this weekend, you know, the architectural tour, and seeing all the beautiful, you know, buildings, you know, all over Chicago. And we came through a section that actually showed a bunch of tents alongside the river. And the other day on the news, last night on the news, they talked about 606 OD. On one of the stations, and they talked about, you know, the fact that there's a whole heroin community living along the river, and you're seeing all the syringes. So wherever you see these tents, you know, there's that type of activity yeah. happening there, and it's breeding. So, you know, on the surface, you know, it looks like, you know, it gives us a little peace of mind, at least in knowing that, you know, they are not exposed to the elements. But there's a lot of activity that's happening there beneath the surface that really needs and desperately needs our attention.
When we get to a situation where a construction project displaces these tent cities, and this is, I mean, this is so hard to understand and to fathom. Does the city, do the people of the city, do we owe a relocation? You know, because this is squatting. I mean, people put a tent up underneath on public property and did it without permission, and really police and others just kind of looked the other way. But is there sort of rights of the homeless to relocate or to get services from the city and others to help them relocate?
I think I don't think the word owe, you know, is a word. Maybe it is. You know, we do owe them a responsibility to give them access, right, to a place where they can go. And I do agree that, you know, we should just not give squatter rights to people to live in public spaces. But there should be a viable alternative that's available that is considered a safe place to go. And I think that if you did read the articles, which many of us did, you know, there is a huge aversion, you know, by the homeless population to go into shelters.
Right. We talked about that before.
But
talk about that. Why aren't they going to the shelters that are provided by the city?
Well, most shelters that are traditional shelters that you think of are basically a place where you can go and you can sleep, and, you know, there's no security on site. There's, you know, people are sleeping in cots next to each other. There's people that are actively high and using, and dangerous situations do occur. You know, and just to give you an example, you know, at a safe haven, it's nothing like you would imagine a homeless shelter to be. For us, it's really a place that gives people back their dignity. It gives them their privacy. They get semi-private suites, I call them.
Right.
And a mother can be at a safe haven and be provided private accommodations where she could share a room with her children and they can close the door and have their privacy. They get semi-private bathrooms. So it is really shatters the perception of what a typical homeless shelter looks like. When a homeless person shows up at a safe haven, there is no sense of fear by most people, unless there's, you know, serious social issues going on with the individual, which we also work with. But, you know, it is, I believe, an opportunity for us to really think about what is the system that we should be supporting. At the end of the day, what is the vision that we want for these people and for anybody that ends up in crisis? In my mind, the vision's clear. You know, the vision's clear. When you have someone that you know that has a problem, you want to send them to a place that's really going to be turnkey. Mm-hmm. It's going to provide them a safe, you know, environment that's going to be conducive, and it's going to be equipped and trained and really proven in terms of their ability to take people from crisis situations to independence. And that really means to their highest level of independence, because everyone's different.
And this is where we left off the conversation before. I mean, do you see a safe haven as a model for the way that municipalities, governments, other taxpayer-funded shelters should operate? I mean, should we be in the business of recognizing this problem? And instead of doing the homeless shelters that probably have been around now for, what, centuries, you know, like that style in which that's what we fund and that's what we put out, like you said, no security, the cots next to each other. Do we need to have a paradigm shift to say, listen, the way we do shelters has to be updated for 2017?
Absolutely, 100%. I had the opportunity to speak this weekend at the Illinois Municipal League. They had a major conference, and that's the Municipal League is basically mayors, city managers, village trustees from across the state that are really coming to learn about some of the best practices happening around various issues, right? So we had the opportunity to speak on reducing homelessness and poverty in your community. And, you know, after having, I had about a 40 minutes opportunity to speak, and I think the Q&A was longer than the than the speaking engagement. And that was because people are yearning, you know, whether it's government, whether it's the general population, we're yearning for ideas that really work and are very productive in terms of achieving the goal of breaking the cycle of poverty and homelessness in a way that's going to be sustainable. We don't want to keep helping the same people over and over. I don't think people want to keep feeding the same people over and over. They want to see these people get back on their own 2 feet, and the people that are in crisis want that for themselves too.
Well, it's part and parcel. I mean, what you mentioned about on the architecture tour, that yes, you'll see from a distance these tents and say, well, that's an interesting concept. But when you get closer, you see drug use, you see heroin, 606 OD is what it's called. I mean, all these issues that are actually stopping people from getting into the shelter system or taking advantage of a safe haven and the opportunity for them to find independence. So it has to work kind of hand in hand, societal issues. So it's one thing to say, hey, we've redone the shelter and we've got nice and it's a tiny home and it's something new. But all that doesn't matter if somebody is still having problems with drugs, alcohol, social issues, things of that nature.
Yeah, and you know, we have that. We have to resist the urge to just react, you know, and to come up with a quick fix. The truth is everyone's different, and we really have to make everybody that we help, you know, path be designed specifically to meet their individual needs. So for us, it's got to be comprehensive. It's got to be assessment driven. If an individual is in crisis from drug and alcohol addiction, that's got to be the first step. Let's help that person deal with that issue in a way that's going to get them in a solid recovery path, and then let's move them into educational classes, let's move them into job training programs, let's move them into jobs, and let's move into permanent housing. So everything has to happen in order of progression in a way that's going to allow them to really benefit from the services that they're getting, and in a way that's going to, you know, take full advantage, allow them to take full advantage of what they're getting.
Nellie Vasquez Rowland is with me. She's the president of Safe Haven Foundation, and I want to get you to talk about the gala, which is coming up in a month or so. But before we do that, I am wondering, what's the relationship, I mean, with the private sector? And we talked about this a little bit last time. I mean, yes, you can get a person from the streets to independence. You find jobs, things of that nature. But to put them into the market where affordable housing is disappearing. I mean, part of the issue that's playing out in Uptown is that there were places where you could get SROs, single room occupancy, that was cheaper than your standard rates. Those are gone. People are redeveloping those. Those are no longer, you know, because of, I was reading a story for college students and others that, you know, you're seeing thousands, $2,000, $3,000 for these one room apartments. I mean, it's ludicrous to think about the way that that's changed. So how do you and how do governments and how do others play to the fact that once somebody is in a position where they're ready to be independent, it's a cruel world in the way that there's not a lot of opportunities that might have even been there 10, 15, 20 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Well, just to give you a little bit of history, you know, and Brian, my husband, and I started A Safe Haven back in 1994. We started out by buying buildings that were crack houses and investing in them and turning them into the crown jewel of the community. And these were communities that were really, desperately in need of investments,
right.
And we continue to do that. So as we move people from getting, you know, all the wraparound services, you're right, the next step is who's going to hire them. And what we do is we do have what we call social business enterprises, which are businesses that actually give them jobs. And the landscaping company we talked about last time I was here, a lot of the work that's done on Michigan Avenue, that company hires people that are ex-offenders. Those are people with barriers to employment opportunities. We're giving them a work ethic. We're getting them the ability to keep a job and, you know, teaching them how to work, and also financial literacy skills so that they know how to manage their money. We also have a catering business. And one of the most important businesses that I think we have is a staffing business. So today we are becoming one of the prime, one of the prime companies, staffing businesses that our employers are coming to, that are looking to hire people that are ready to go to work and are motivated. And we have a track record for having people that we place into jobs to have very high retention rates with our employers. So that's very exciting. So a lot of employers right now are in hiring mode, and I'm talking to them all the time, and they're looking to hire people that may have made some mistakes in the past but have cleaned themselves up. They're ready to go to work because they've gone through our rigorous job training program. So, you know, we do job training programs. We train people for welding. We train people for the culinary arts, you know, customer service, security jobs. We partner with other job training companies so that as people, we have more people than we can, you know, we have 5,000 people a year, right? And by the way, last year, 858 of them were military veterans, which makes A Safe Haven the largest provider of services for military veterans.
I feel like we could do a whole hour on that.
Yeah, yeah.
Military veteran that should be on the street. Before I let you go, and this is the last question, you know, with all of the talk about inequality, and we see the haves and the have-nots, we just had the conversation with Pastor Corey Brooks as well. From your perch, from being at a safe haven, do you see a change? You see more people joining the ranks of the homeless population in Chicago, or is it the other way around that you see a decrease in the number of people that are homeless?
Oh, no, there's definitely been an explosion of people that are homeless, I would say at least over the last 10 years. And that really corresponds with the fact that when the economy, broke back in 2008, I can't believe it's going to be almost 10 years from, you know, a lot of people did not get the chance and the opportunity to recover and fell from the middle class and into poverty. And, you know, I believe that there's a huge percentage of people that are literally one paycheck away from being homeless themselves. So we see a huge rise in that SEAM 606OD story that was done yesterday. They talked about the fact that we had 6,500 people OD in the city limits of the city of Chicago. So President Trump did declare, you know, a national epidemic with the opiate issue, and that is, you know, growing by leaps and bounds. I'm going to say about 4,000% in at least the last 10 years. So those are some of the driving forces, you know, the fact that we had, you know, the economy, you know, triggered this problem of poverty with the middle class, you know, for the first time falling through the cracks, people coming out of the criminal justice system, not being able to get jobs, and the idea of having this opiate epidemic. It's a perfect storm. And the beauty is that at A Safe Haven, we are well positioned to deal with all of those different types of issues in a way that's holistic, it's comprehensive, it's housing, it's jobs, and it's access to, you know, mainstreaming and turning people into positive, productive members of society. We had people that we placed into jobs last year that made over $20 million in income.
Yeah, there you go. Mm-hmm. Nellie Vasquez Rowland, she is the president of Safe Haven Foundation. The gala is coming up on November 4th.
Yes.
It is for homeless veterans. So you can find all the information at Safe Haven's website?
Yes, and our theme this year is called Heroes and Hope, and it is a benefit for military veterans. We're going to be hosting it at the CineSpace Film Studio, which is home to Empire and to Chicago PD and Chicago Fire. And we're going to be honoring Alex Pizios, who's the owner of the film studio. We've done a lot of economic development together in North Lawndale, and I see that as an opportunity to really raise more awareness and more support. And, you know, there's a lot of things people can do to help the homeless right here in our own backyard. So I invite them to go to our website, asafehaven.org. You can volunteer. You can hire people from A Safe Haven. You can donate. You can sponsor the gala or just buy a ticket and come out and have a good time. Meet lots of great people in Chicago doing great things.
Nellie Vasquez Rowland, the president of A Safe Haven Foundation. Thanks for coming in. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Justin.
All right, coming up, we'll play the worst, 312-981-7200. The Cubs right now losing 7-3, bottom of the seventh inning. Not looking good down in St. Louis. Also, the Milwaukee Brewers have a one-run lead in the ninth inning. So if the Brewers win and, of course, the Cardinals win, there will be no clinching tonight.
Well, Bob, that's just pushing back the inevitable now, isn't it?
See, you and I, Rob, we, you know, as more of the Sox variety, we're kind of like, they'll do it tomorrow. They'll do it Thursday.
It's all right.
The Pete Zimmermans of the world, the Cubs diehard, they're like, God, this is the end. People are texting and they're saying, I have not lost that feeling, that emotional feeling, that psyche that something's going to go wrong. I don't know.
It's too much history, man.
It really is, right? That's, I guess, what it's come down to. This is Chicago's very own 720 WGN Chicago, WGNRadio.com. If you're an Amazon Echo user, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. All right, we're going to play the worst coming up. 312-981-7200. All right, let's play the worst, 312-981-7200. Well, the Chicago Cubs, it's up to them now, as the Milwaukee Brewers took care of the Cincinnati Reds with a 7-6 win. So we turn to St. Louis. If the Cubs are going to clinch the division tonight, they're going to have to overcome an 8-3 deficit late in the game in the eighth inning. So we'll keep you up to speed on that. Maybe the Cubs have done it before, and we'll pay attention to it. But as of right now, we'll move on to more pressing matters. And the pressing matters, of course, is it's time for the worst. 312-981-7200. This, of course, our Tuesday night segment where we complain about the worst things in society for prizes. And I've got the OG of prizes. I've got 3 Lou Malnati pizzas to give away. We're messing around with no tickets to anything or memberships or life supply of this, that, or whatever. Tonight, hardcore, straight ahead, 3 Lou Malnati's pizzas. And that's the stuff that you're going for. 312-981-7200. In studio tonight, 2 members of the the Funny Ha Ha crew. This crew, of course, is going to be on stage Friday at the good old Hideout. Claire Zelke, one of the founders. Claire, great to see you.
Hey, Justin.
Always, and a regular here on The Worst.
I got so many things to complain about.
And joining us, a newbie, but a great writer in Chicago, Wendy McClure. Wendy, good to see you.
Hi, Justin.
Oh, my gosh. We've known each other for years.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Wendy is the author of the Wanderville Middle School series. She's also the Wilder Life, which is the little House on the Prairie book. But also you can find out all your stuff at WendyMcClure.net. I need to get you in here at the big table sometime.
Oh, yeah.
Because you've had such a great writing career and love to talk, but you're going to be part of Funny Ha Ha. Funny Ha Ha this week. What do we have on the lineup for Friday?
It is the witching hour, so it's all witches. We've got author Lindsay Hunter, Sarah Hollenbeck, owner of Women and Children First, Saya Hillman from Mac and Cheese Productions, Adrian Gunn, a comedian, Jen Sabella, she does Girl Talk, and Zena Camblin. So, and Wendy. And so
Wendy's old school.
Yeah,
Wendy's been on this show for how many times have you done Funny Ha Ha now?
I think it's like, what, my fifth time,
Probably.
There you go,
Yeah. So we're going to find out finally if women are funny or not. This is going to be the deciding night.
This is the night?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All right. 312-981-7200. Why don't we start The Worst as we do every Tuesday night with Pete Zimmerman. Pete, why don't you kick us off, buddy?
You know what's the worst?
What's the worst, Pete?
When you order food and they fail to deliver one of the lesser items, like you really want the cheese sticks.
Or like the ranch on the side.
Right, and they don't come.
Right.
And you have to think, like, I really want the cheese sticks. Do I make them come back?
Do I got to reorder?
Yeah. Yeah, you suffer. And then, like, you're like, yeah, bring me back the cheese sticks. And then a guy comes and judges you.
Right.
Like, okay, Tubbs, did you really need me to come back for the second time?
For the second time, did you need to bring the cheese sticks?
I feel your pain. There is a pizza place I cannot mention, but for about a year, they neglected to add the croutons to the salad. But I couldn't bring myself to call them and say, can you put the croutons on the salad? They started bringing them back, so I'm giving them another chance. But I completely understand.
And I go the exact opposite way. I'm into a puddle. If my cheese sticks aren't there, I curse the world, but I would never have the stones to actually call him back.
I call and I say, this is just a little thing. But it gets them, so they reassure me, you know? And, you know, I'm like, it's just a little thing. And they're like, no.
No, it's not a little thing.
Cool. It's cool.
Good. All right. All right, Claire, you want to start us off? What do you got for the worst?
My worst right now is fall outdoor decor.
just in general?
I'm just resenting the like implied pressure that I have to buy a bunch of pumpkins and gourds and husks of corn.
Dress it up.
Can I just live my life and, you know, the marigolds, the hearty mums. So I don't think I'm going to do it. I'm sorry, everyone. I'm just not doing it.
Right.
The whole tableau, right?
Yeah. You know, the squirrel comes, starts dragging it around. It's only October 2nd, so...
And these all have to be, you have to buy them. You have to go out. You have to make a trip.
Yeah.
And
I bought literally $100 worth of pumpkins last year, lined them all up on my steps. It looked completely inadequate. I was really mad at myself.
Yeah. Actually, I hate all fall decor, even the Halloween stuff, actually. Mm. I mean, no, actually, I will qualify that. I hate the store-bought Halloween stuff now.
Like
there's so much of it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And everyone's house has, they've got the skulls coming out of the lawn, and it's like the Colonel Kurtz compound.
And everyone just
now
went to aisle 22 of Target.
Yeah.
It's not like they went and figured it out or crafted it in the garage. No, they just go to, I know that aisle so well.
Right.
I walked out, I'm like, oh, that's my block.
Yeah. Not even Target, Walgreens. We've all been to that same aisle. We've all seen that talking skeleton playing the banjo. So I'm taking a knee on that.
All right. All right, Wendy, what do you got for the worst?
Burger smell.
Just in general.
No, when it's not burger time. Which one. I don't think that's too much to ask because, you know, pretty much, you know, that is any time except morning. But have you walked by like a Burger King or some other place in the morning and there's burger smell.
And it feels, you smell that burger. You're right.
It's not.
Or like at the airport when you get off a late flight and the McDonald's is closed, but it's still got the leftover smell.
And like Burger Time it's not available to you anymore.
Yeah.
So,
if I could give pizzas, that might be my favorite worst of all time. Burger Time, burger smell when it's not Burger Time. I love it. 312-981-7200. All right, we got some people on the line. Dave, Judy, we also got texts coming in fast and furious. We'll do this. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll start it up. We'll start with you, Dave. Stay with us.
It's going down, y'all.
All right, so we're 312-981-7200 in studio with me tonight. Claire Zuehlke and Wendy McClure. They are both at Funny Haha on Friday at the Hideout. 6 o'clock start? 6:30?
6:30. 6:45, but get there, get your drinks, get your seats.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Cash.
Yeah, but
cash,
you know.
Cash when you start.
Yeah, that's the Chicago traffic real-time start Friday night. But yeah.
All right, 312-981-7200. We're playing for pizza. Let's get the game started. Let's start with Dave. Dave,
hey.
What's the worst, Dave?
Okay, it's still kind of summery out. So you're at the produce section. You see these beautiful-looking nectarines and peaches.
Mm-hmm.
So you want to buy 3 or 4 pounds of them.
Oh,
get a lot of them because they look so great.
Lot, right?
So you bring them home. You wait and wait and wait 7 or so days for them to get soft. They're finally soft. So you take one, put them in the water, rinse them off. You bite into it, and it's like, ugh, they're mealy. So you try the next one, same thing. The whole batch is just worthless.
Mealy.
They're all mealy.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, you just wait and wait for the stuff to ripen, and, you know, it's terrible. It happens.
I'm with you on that.
You know, like 50% of the time it happens to me. It's, you know, fruit's a gamble.
Stone fruit especially is a gamble. But it's like if you go to Target or Trader Joe's and you get the bananas that go right from green to brown. Immediately.
I've never had that, but I've had the same thing happen with danjo pears because I like them if they're ripe. But, you know, so much of the time, you know, it's disappointing because you wait and wait and wait and they look so great in the store.
Yeah.
I have one good peach a summer.
Yeah, yeah.
Just one.
Something's got to be done about that. I mean, I remember a Seinfeld episode like that, but it's real. That's reality.
Right. There's good places that have it right. Thanks, Dave. Appreciate it.
Okay. Bye.
All right. There we go. All right. Let's go to Judy. Judy, what's the worst, Judy?
Me?
Yep.
Oh, I was telling them that the worst for me is when you see people in the grocery store in Pilates pants when they should really be in the gym.
Oh.
it's disgusting.
The Pilates pants are disgusting?
Well, the people in the Pilates
are they sweaty?
Most of the time, and they're not really good looking. They should really still be.
Oh, I see. I see. Okay, I wasn't paying attention to it. It was an ugly.
Yeah, if they should really still be in the gym.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Maybe for about 3 more years.
All right, there you go. Thanks, Judy.
Okay.
I think that was me. No, it's okay.
I feel like I will when I go to the gym. On the occasion that I do, I always find myself in a Target afterwards. I feel like I'm drawn to it.
Yeah.
And then I just feel like my shirt's a little sweaty, like, just like in a spot where I'm like, so I feel like at first I thought she was talking about me. I'm like, the guy who comes from the Pilates class. But no, she was just body shaming.
I wear my gym clothes in the morning too, and because I work out after drop off, but sometimes I go to the store. So that was me, but that's okay. But I sometimes go to the stores where they're like it's an orthodox, you know, customer base, and I then get really self conscious. I'm like,
do you care?
Well, I
what
just
do you
don't
care
wanna,
about wearing.
I'm just curious about whether I look like a, you know.
Are you wearing halter tops? What are you talking about?
You're
wearing,
you know,
workout
me.
Pants.
I'm naked. That's how I like to work out.
That's ridiculous. What is this? This is the worst for 1963. We can't wear tight pants to the store.
Yeah.
All right. 312-981-7200. All right. Here we go. Ready? Let's see what we got here. 224 says the worst, driving and running late. You drive around a blind corner and just miss getting over the tracks, and it's a long freight train.
Yeah. Oh. Yeah. One of those ones that's like 3 miles long.
Oof.
Yeah. And you try counting the cars.
Yeah.
And it doesn't make it any better.
It doesn't. Well, we were in Berwyn for a show. We did a show a couple weeks ago at Laverne's. It's been only been a week or so. But when we were doing the show, it's right on one of the train lines there. And it was just constant freight trains all Friday night. Like every time I put just where our table was in this great bar, it would to the windows. And I would look up and it would just be a freight train. And I'd be doing the segment talking to somebody and I'd look up and it'd be a freight train. Like it just never stopped.
Yeah.
It's like, how do people get across these tracks? And then Charlie Meyerson said, Oak Park figured out to do the tracks. They dug them out so you can go underneath it. But Berwyn hadn't, so there's just a ton of people just waiting for minutes.
My cousin lives in Morton Grove, and she lives up right by the train tracks, and she'll have a kid party, and they'll have all this fun toys in the back, but then the train will go by and all the kids will flock to the fence, and they watch the train. Right. So they don't need anything. They can just watch the train.
630 says, the worst is when it's all 90 degrees out in September, and your friend in the passenger seat of your car loses a chunk of a chocolate bar in between the seats.
Oh,
what is
yeah.
that? That's hilarious.
When I got married, it was an 80-degree day in October, and I was eating chocolate chip cookies in the limo between the ceremony and the reception, and I got chocolate, melted chocolate on my wedding gown.
Oh, no.
So that would... I felt very pretty.
That was very... That was a story to tell.
Yeah.
And that's what weddings are about, Claire. A story to tell.
Yes.
219 says, the worst is when, as a service worker, a patron calls your name, lifts a full ashtray, and just motions you with their finger to empty it out. Uh-huh. Like you're their paid help.
Ugh. Yeah.
The ashtray's full.
Right.
That's a weird
gesture.
I don't
know where this is going on.
Yeah. And they know your name.
Yeah. That is the weirdest part.
Yeah.
We were at a place over the weekend, and there was people like in seats next to the table next to us, and then we came over and replaced these people, and they had left their cups and stuff. So my wife grabbed the cups to like put them away, yeah. And the person, the other people that were sitting next to us, gave her all their empties. While you're up, why don't you take ours while you're there?
Did she have like a...
She like just grabbed them and like, okay. And...
strange outfit on?
No.
It was like a white top and black pants? Or what was that?
I don't know.
They were just like, while you're up?
Yeah, while you're up, why don't you take these cups too?
Weird.
That's the worst.
Can I do another one? A Twitter?
Yeah.
When there's a name trending and you're curious about like who it is, and maybe it's like some guy who's been arrested, like maybe this is going to be some new, you know, like it's gonna be like the new thing that we're all going to be talking about, and it's a sports guy. Even worse, yeah. It's like a sports guy from another country. And I'm like, I think there should be an icon on Twitter that shows sports guy.
Sports related.
Sports thing.
Sports
yeah.
thing.
I think Twitter should know my interests and just not give me that.
Well,
you know?
That would be good.
Yeah.
I think it's time that they keep talking about toying with the how long the characters are. I'm like, no. We should have a filter system where's that trusted algorithm?
That's called an email at that point.
right. All right. 773 says the worst is when you bend over to pick up a coin and it's covered with a slimy, clear, sticky fluid.
Okay. That's very specific.
That's very specific. A lot of adjectives there. Okay. The worst is when you're on the highway and a police car is right behind you. For over 5 miles.
Yeah.
And it's impossible to move into the slower lane. It feels like guilt by association when you literally can't stay under the radar and other drivers are looking at you strangely.
Yeah. The accidental escort. I've had that. It makes you self-conscious.
Yeah. All right. Mary's got a great one. At the grocery store. The worst is when you're at the grocery store. When you try to get... where'd it go? The ton just came in here. Did I just lose it? One second, sorry. All right. Try to get a cart separated from the long chain of carts, and it won't release. And you're yanking, and you're yanking, and you're yanking, and you're swearing, and people are waiting for you to finish. It's the worst.
Yeah.
That is really the worst.
309 says, the worst is when someone burns their popcorn at work, and the smell just spreads throughout the office.
Yeah, although it's not as bad as fish. Fish in the microwave.
Oh, yeah, that's the rule. That's the rule.
Yeah.
Fish.
708 says the worst is pumpkin spice, anything other than pie.
Yeah. I've given in a little bit.
We've crossed that threshold.
Yeah,
we can't go back.
We're
through
the looking glass now. Like, I was eyeing the pumpkin spice Cheerios the other day. I was like, I can do that.
Does it have to have pumpkin in the, you know?
No, you're right.
There's no pumpkin.
It should just be spice.
It should just be spice.
That's
right.
That's,
But then some things kind of taste like Michael's Crafts.
Yeah.
So that's true.
That is true.
Or like tastes like a candle.
Am I the only person that goes into Michael's and does try to put all that stuff in his mouth? Like, I feel like half the time I'm like, does this go in my mouth? Like, does this taste? What is, oh, it's just a, it's glue.
It's glue.
I figured it out.
Well, you're confusing Michael's Crafts with Michael's Foods. So, they shouldn't put them next to each other.
They shouldn't. 847's got, it's the worst, plantar fasciitis. They can be medical worsts.
True.
Yeah.
You know?
I have sad feet. I have that.
Oh. Yeah, see? Yeah. So it's the worst, right?
Yeah.
You can, that's, that. It's, see, this is the world giving you the algorithm, right?
Yeah,
they play to your interests.
I can talk about this. I can talk about the awful catalogs that I get now for having this. It's the sad feet catalog.
Yeah.
You get the sad feet catalog?
Yeah, yeah.
Did you sign up for that Sad Feet catalog, or they just figured it out? She's Googling. She's Googling my feet hurt.
Yeah.
And they're like, send her the Sad Feet catalog.
I got on the expensive children's Halloween costume catalog.
Oh, ooh, that's
it. I think it's called Fireflies, and they're like $300 like princess fairy costumes. I don't know
that's sad
what
mom.
I bought that.
That's Sad Mom catalog. That's yeah. That's a different
Well,
catalog.
Especially because it's usually like 1,000 girl costumes, and right. then there's like a boy costume where he's dressed like a dragon. Or something like that. He's her assistant.
All right, 708's got the worst is being sabotaged by the previous person that closed the door of the refrigerator, okay, cabinet or closet. They stuffed everything in knowing full well that the next person to open the door would be hit with an avalanche.
Yeah.
That's a good
yeah.
one. Mm-hmm. That's a strong one.
Yeah.
You're going to have to figure that one out.
That's like sort of like the person leaving the last square of toilet paper on the roll and thinking that's
yeah.
doesn't require a change.
There's a level of selfishness and laziness
yeah,
that goes
yeah.
into all of that,
mm-hmm.
which is okay. Glare Zolke, Wendy McClure in studio tonight. We're playing the worst. Let's do this. Let's take a break. We'll get an update with Rob and the news. Get up to date on that Cubs game, which is entering the ninth inning. The Cardinals right now with an 8-7 lead, so getting close and close here. We're actually in the bottom of the eighth. There's a pitching change, so we'll get to all that with Rob and the news. We're playing the worst. Stay with us. All right, thanks, Rob. 312-981-7200. It's the download. We're playing the worst. The Cardinals are winning right now 8-7 in the eighth inning. They are continuing to rally. And they got two outs with runners on first and second, so we'll keep you up to date on that game. Of course, if the Cubs win, they clinch. They have to win because the Milwaukee Brewers also won tonight, so we'll pay attention to that. But like I said, they're right now in the bottom of the eighth inning. In studio tonight to play the worst, Wendy McClure, Claire Zolke. They're both beyond funny haha this Friday night at the Hideout, 1354 West Waubonsie, a 6:30 p.m. show.
Yes.
It's, of course, a collection of, what do you call this, a live literary, humor literary?
Chicago's favorite live lit humor
yeah,
show.
Yeah, see, I knew you had a whole thing, right?
Yeah.
You had a whole thing?
It's like, you know, when you want to laugh, but you don't want a stand-up comedian or a sketch comedy or improv or a trained comedian yeah. making you laugh.
Or a professional.
Right, yeah.
If you want to laugh, but you really don't want people who do
right.
it for a living.
If you want to see someone you follow on Instagram who lives in your neighborhood read a funny story.
There you
stand
go.
Stand with a piece of paper
with
in front
of a piece of paper.
Him.
I love it.
Yeah, yeah, that's guys, Justin's favorite part.
You guys
yeah.
have really, really sold it.
Yeah.
You really killed it. So that's good. All right. 312-981-7200 is the phone number. Let's get back to the worst. The worst are cell phone customer service people. This is 708.
Yeah.
And then 847 is very simple. Three trips to the cable company for a minor change, plus an evening spent on the phone with tech support, and the new cable box still not working. Yeah, that's the worst.
Yeah.
I had a situation today where I turned on the TV and it was giving me a code that was I'd never seen before, like, you know, check your wires. And we have a cat. We got a cat, right? And it's the first time now where I'm like, a cat's always messing around back there by the cords, right? So I was like, I had quick thinking. We have two TVs and both of them have cable. So I ran downstairs and I was like, turned it on and it was on. Mm. So I'm like, ah, that cat. So I went upstairs, I was underneath, and I plugged all the wires back in, and it worked. So I was like, I feel like I accomplished
yeah,
something,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
I beat the man.
Right.
Because that could have been a lot of tech support and a lot
yeah.
of on hold.
A lot
and the
of
whole
unplugging
thing.
And yep. plugging back in.
No, nope, yeah. I was able to take it into my own hands there.
Good
so.
For you.
There, there we go. All right, let's keep going here. 847 says the worst is waking up from a dream about eating a piece of sausage pizza and really having a taste for it, but it was a dream, so you don't have any. All right, knock it off. 312 says the worst is Judy for being so judgy. No. And then, wow, this really struck a nerve here. 815, Barb's like the worst women of any age in public who should not be wearing stretch leggings.
Women in public, wow. Period.
Yeah.
Get rid of it. 312, worse is paying for ripped jeans.
Yeah.
I like that yeah. one. That's a good one.
It's happening.
I'm
like
old
the ripped
in that
jeans.
Sense that I won't, no.
Yeah.
Right? Me neither.
Yeah.
I did buy a pair with cut-off bottoms, but I under duress.
Yeah. I know I'll have the little frayed, you know, hems and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. But
yeah, you're but, absolutely yeah, right. I don't think I could go into a store and be like, what a great rip. I'm gonna this is worth an extra 30 on this. This rip is so fantastic. Why would anyone do that? Did they not grow up in the 80s?
No.
Like we did, where we did that on purpose.
Well, you know,
we know how to do it.
90s jeans are back, too. Like Jennifer Aniston and Friends, first season of Friends jeans are back. Gigi Hadid. Yeah. Check it out. It's happening.
It's happening?
Yeah.
Oh, no.
It's horrible.
Wait, what jeans are these?
Like the high-waisted, kind of stone-washed.
Yeah. Yeah, that wash.
Right.
Oh, that wash.
Right.
630, the worst is hearing a siren when driving. Panic to pull over to the curb and stop, then realize a siren is a sound effect on the radio. Usually as part of a commercial or public service announcement. Same for hearing phone sounds that match your phone's sounds coming from the radio.
Yeah.
Yeah, that happens to me. There's a GN commercial where there's like a phone ring. And I'm always like, hello?
Yeah.
Yeah. 773 says the worst, elementary school photos. You pay a fortune for the photo package, and it looks like your child's in a booking photo at the police station.
Yes.
No smile, deer in the headlights.
Right. Yeah. Yes. I just said this on Facebook. Like, where is the option for one photo on LifeTouch? I'd pay $20 for one photo. Instead, I'm going to get 12 2x3s that I'm going to give 10 to you guys, because what do I get?
I'll take one.
Okay, because we have two sets of grandparents. Nobody else wants, though. Like, you know.
They do. The packages are out of date. I agree with you. You can get 8 4x8s and 2 6x10s. And
you can get the retouching. Like, I don't know if anyone's actually gotten the retouching. And if you're like, ooh, my kids look a little tired these days.
There's a scammy element to it, too. I forgot it. I'm just getting late in the show, but I know that there's a third picture that's taken in the year, or maybe a second picture.
Mm.
You get this, and CPS does this, where there's a second picture in March,
mm-hmm.
and it comes to your house, and they, if you don't return it at a certain point, you gotta get photos. It's like right out of like Columbia House, penny for 10 CDs, whatever they're doing there. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah,
I'd like to. I'm gonna call Chuck Gowdy.
I was.
And he'll help me out with the investigation on this.
Go ahead.
Is it so you can see how your child has changed over the year? I don't like. Why do you? I don't have a kid, so I don't know.
It's
how they
not
grow.
The original photo that you did all the dress up. It's a second photo.
Wow.
It's like a trick photo.
It's a trick photo.
Yeah.
And I hats off to my wife. You know what she did, which is awesome, is she purposely dressed our son down.
Mm.
And so he's wearing just his regular T-shirt. So you don't succumb to you get the picture like, oh, he's so cute with the collared shirt. You know, like it's just a regular picture. His hair is all messed up. And you're like, no, I don't want this. I can take this on my phone.
Yeah.
It's great. And you're like, all right, you don't get... Because I think the idea is that, another picture. I need to document this moment. March is so important. April is so important. All right, 815, going for a day trip to visit family downstate and having a result in an emergency room visit and having your car break down and towed twice to a repair shop due to different problems. Yeah, that is the worst.
Yeah.
Now you're really taking this literal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's too much. It puts so much stress on me.
Mm-hmm.
Like at some point or another, I got to go visit the folks up in Wisconsin. It's too much. You just put too much voodoo.
Yeah.
Yeah.
773 says the worst is biting into a frozen candy bar and breaking a crown, $1,400.
Yeah.
Wow, we're getting real serious. It's taken a tone. Has it not taken a tone?
Yeah. We need something like much more frivolous than that.
All right. 312's got, you know what's the worst? Helmet hair.
That's pretty bad.
Yeah. But you know what's even worse than that? Death.
Exactly. all right, keep going here. 214 says, when you've gained too much weight, your fingers get stuck in the bowling ball. I don't know. I don't know about that one.
I think there are lots of bowling ball options.
Yeah.
But maybe you have your favorite one. I guess I can see that.
847 said, kids waiting right outside the grocery store exit with their parents selling candy to raise money for something. You say, no, not today. Then you realize that you forgot to get something. So you go and you got to come out again. That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Not with anything. Not just with kids with candy. Just anyone waiting at the door.
Yeah.
I will say what really gets me is when someone who is asking for money, and this is all on me. I do not at all. But someone's outside of Walgreens. Hey, can you get any money to spare? I'm like, I don't have any, man. I have no cash. And then I forget something. I got to go back in.
Yeah.
And I come back out and they go, you got any money? I'm like, you don't remember me?
Right.
Like, I was just here 5 minutes ago and I said I didn't have money. And I, like, some reason there's indignant. Like, I'm so indignant about it. I get so angry, but I'm like, what is this guy supposed to remember every face that comes out of the highly trafficked pharmacy downtown Chicago?
Because you have to lie again.
That's exactly it.
I never wish I was invisible as much as I do at the grocery store. Yeah. Like, once a guy tried to pick me up at the grocery store and I was so angry. So it's like, any place else, even the gas station, I'll take it. But at the grocery store, I'm trying to do my business. I'm looking for that one peach, you know?
Right. Yeah, the one peach you eat.
Don't talk to me.
Don't talk to me.
Don't make me have to figure out how to gently say thank you. But
I don't think I've ever in my life talked to anybody at a grocery store. You know, like, I'll run into friends and it'll be like, can I get away with a head nod?
Yeah.
Can I, you know, I've known this guy for a long time. My buddy Jeremiah, I see him all the time in the West Loop. And I'm always like, I want to give him a head nod. I mean, I'll talk to him. He's a great guy. But it's like, it's funny. Yeah, like, yeah. I'm like, oh.
It's the lighting. Yeah. You don't want to be seen in that lighting. Yeah.
And again, you can only run into them once. And then you have to, you can't again. You have to stay out of their way. You actually have to sort of like look around corners and see if they're coming. And then not cross their path again. Because then you're like,
extremely efficient. Because, the second time, because we're you again. we're just going to do this. Huh? Yeah.
But then when you have to go back and get something from another aisle, and then you see them.
My worst is leaving the reusable bags in the car, and then you get in the store, and you've got the full cart. And I had my kid with me the other day, too. So I was like, I can't leave this two-year-old in the store. But I can't take this cart back out. So I guess now I'm going to take all these bags home.
They got you.
Yeah.
They got you 15 cents.
Yeah. Big bag.
Big bag. Gotcha. Yeah.
And you look like a bad person.
Yeah. Exactly.
Claire Zuehlke, Wendy McClure in studio tonight. Playing the worst. 312-981-7200. We'll take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll read the rest of them. And we'll pick top three for pizza. Stay with us.
What's going down,
all right, it's the wrapping up of the worst tonight. 312-981-7200. We're paying attention to the Cubs right now. Down a run in the ninth inning. Nobody out, but they got their first guy on base. Right now, the Cubs down to the St. Louis Cardinals in the ninth inning, 8-7, a victory, and they clinch. All right, so we'll wrap up here with the worst. Claire Zuehlke, Wendy McClure, both at Funny Haha this Friday night, 1354 West Wabansia at the Hideout, one of my favorite places. I went to the block party this past weekend. Pete did as well. It's good. So it's a good place.
Yeah.
Done a lot of shows there.
But
so
it was nice and hot out there in the
parking
lot.
It was fun. Yeah. It was fun right in the parking lot.
Under the heat dome.
Yep. That's right. 312-981-7200. All right. 608 says the worst is when you take a quick peek in someone's medicine cabinet only to have 15 marbles fall out.
And that was for you. You did that. Then you did that to yourself, though.
Yeah. What are you doing? I gotta go in anyone's medicine cabinet. I've never in my life been like, oh, I'm at a party and I'm gonna use the bathroom. I'm like, let me see what's going on. What deodorant do they use?
I kind of looked.
You gotta really plan that though with the marbles.
Yeah,
yeah, right.
Like, I mean, that's sort of a jerk move. Like,
you do. You go in and check people's.
Well,
why? What's
I sometimes want to know how fancy their eye cream is. Like, if they're using La Mer or what.
Brands are important.
Yeah. I need to know where I stand.
Yeah.
847, I don't know if this is a joke or not. A drunk hit my secretary's car, injuring her mother. Drunk hit on my second secretary at the scene. Oh. That's a lot going on there.
Yeah.
414 says the worst is having your mother-in-law come for a visit but does not tell you when she's leaving. I just thought I'd stay. Yeah. Looks like you need an extra pair of hands here.
Yeah. I won't be in the way.
773 says the worst is eating a staple from a Chinese food container.
Oh,
yeah.
Actually, I once had a fortune cookie, and then I ate it, and then I realized after the fact that there was no fortune, and I couldn't tell if I'd eaten the fortune or if there was no fortune.
Oh, it's just a gobble. That's hilarious. 708 says eye contact through a public bathroom stall.
Mm. Oh, like through the crack, you mean? Oh.
That is weird. 214 says the worst, warts.
Yeah.
That'll do it. Audis, 514 says belly buttons. How does that happen, by the way? Did the doctor lift up the baby by the cord to show mommy or what? I don't know.
There's a lot of body shaming tonight.
Yeah. Having an Audi? Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Okay.
309 says the worst is when the prize patrol parks in front of your house but walks the balloons and cardboard check up to your neighbor's porch.
Oh, my God. That would be horrible.
Is that a thing? That's hilarious.
Do they really come?
Yeah. I didn't thought that was always a commercial. Like, they really do a prize.
Sure.
Yeah.
That would be the horror. That would be awful. Yeah. That'd be like when you're at the baseball game and there's the fan cam in the section next to you. And you're like, I'm so much better. Yeah. I should be on the scoreboard.
Or like being like Bozo Buckets, you know, when you were a kid and watch Bozo Circus. And that thing would go around and, you know, hope it would land on you.
Yeah. I don't know. Like, I didn't know there was an actual prize bus. Now I'm intrigued. I guess it's, whatever. 312, trying to read signers' lips, total gibberish. They do that to mess with us. signers' lips? Is that what they mean? Yeah.
Maybe, like, when there's, like, someone who's, like, a sign language interpreter and they are, like, speaking along or something like that?
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. 773, the worst is walking barefoot and stepping on your kid's Legos. Which is, but that's also one that is one of, that's like the original worst.
Yeah.
That's like a best of.
That's an OG.
Like, yeah. 918, the worst, grapes with seeds.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Why? The only person who buys those is my mom, and she's making a beautiful centerpiece, and they're part of the display.
Would she do the thing with the egg white and the sugar? My grandma would do that.
Wow.
Yeah. Ooh. Would sort of frost them.
My mom's been slacking.
Oh, yeah.
She also buys the tiny pears for these two, the ones that they sell at Whole Foods that nobody eats, but the ones that are like as big as a grape, basically.
Right, yeah.
Fancy. 918 continues, if the technology exists for them to be seedless, why in the world do grapes have seeds?
Yeah, correct.
Yeah.
Use the technology.
Yeah.
It's just lazy grape farmers.
Right.
They're just,
I'm not going to bother.
They're like, they skip the training day.
Yeah.
When the technology, they're like, this is the new technology. Yeah. We will no longer have seeds. Yeah, well, okay. They're making jokes in the back of the room when it turns time for them to turn on the program. I don't know how to use this.
Yeah. You have to eat them privately. And
things, so it's too much work for too little payoff. So much produce.
So much.
It's really produce.
I wrote down avocado. Like when you get an avocado and you cut it open, and you know it's like $2.50 for that avocado. You cut it open, and it's 90% pit.
Mm. Oof. Yeah. Oof. That's no good. And then finally tonight, I think 773 is just messing with us, but a rubber band and fettuccine Alfredo takeout. Right? And then 630, he ends it with a, people who have found God. Yeah? Where? Oh, man.
Dark taste.
Yeah, right? There's a lot. There's a diverse array of worsts.
Go ahead.
It's the heat dome, I tell you.
Yeah.
It just boiled everyone's brains.
We got to take care of each other. We got to look out for each other.
And that's how we end every worst, with a moment of uplifting positivity.
Hold hands.
What's our moment of positivity?
Can I do one more?
Yeah.
We went to the movies yesterday, and they did the previews, and I could hear people whispering after every preview whether or not they would see the movie. And I
see that one. Oh, I'm not going to see that one.
Oh, God.
It's better than me. I do. I always mess with my wife whenever the preview's over. I say really loud so everyone hears. I go, oh. Like, oh, I'm going to go with that one. And she's so over it. Over it. And I'm so into it.
She's so mean.
So mean. At my 20th year of going, oh. She's like, do you really need to do that?
Yeah.
Like, do you really need to do that? All right, tonight we're giving away a Lou Malnati's gift certificate. Lou Malnati's is home of Chicago's best deep dish pizza. Find one of their 40-plus Chicagoland locations or order online at loumalnati's.com. Claire Zilke, Wendy McClure, both going to be on stage at Funny Haha, the live-lit funniest live humor, live literary.
Funny stories. Funny storytelling. $10 at the door, and the proceeds benefit Sit, Stay, Read, which teaches kids, at-risk kids, to read by reading out loud to dogs. It's proven, scientifically proven, to work, but it's a really great time. And it ends at 8:30, so you can get home, get the babysitter, go out for dinner. It's not going to be one of those late shows.
Right.
So.
Claire, of course, the producer and the founder of Funny Haha, and also Wendy McClure is also the author of the Wanderville Middle School series, The Wilder Life, Little House on the Prairie, booking on, so you can find out your work at wendymcclure.net. All right, so here we go. The top three tonight that are going to win pizzas. 312 says, paying for ripped jeans. Done.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Done. It is the worst.
Yeah.
What a terrible thing. 773, number two, you bend over to pick up a coin, and it's covered with a slimy, clear, sticky fluid. The use of adjectives there.
Yeah. Unforgettable.
Really worked. Mm-hmm. And number one tonight, we're going to give it to Dave. Dave for buying pounds and pounds of peaches, biding time. 7 days, he said, to get these things ready to go. Washes them off, takes a bite, and they're mealy. Mm. Takes another bite from a different peach, mealy. Mm-hmm. All that time, all that money, all that fruit, wasted. So we'll replace it with a Lou Malnati's pizza. How about that?
Yes.
Sound good?
Never
sound
mealy.
Good? You guys, Wendy, Claire, great to see you. Thanks for playing tonight.
Thanks, Justin.
Awesome. All right, that's going to do it tonight. Tomorrow on the program, Otis Wilson.
What?
Yep, longtime Chicago Bear. Has a new book about playing football. We'll talk to him, of course, about football and about his time with Chicago. And much, much more. We got a great show tomorrow night. I'm very excited about it. Hopefully the Cubs will clinch tonight, but if they don't tonight, we'll do it tomorrow. Patty Vasquez, Pretty Late with Patty Vasquez up next. Hey, Patty.
Hey, the whole first 10, 15, 20 minutes of my show might just be watching the Cubs game.
Yeah, right?
One night I was here last year and I was almost got in trouble for basically doing sort of a vague play-by-play. So this is going to be very tense.
It's so hard.
We'll see what happens.
I did the same stuff last year. It was hard. It was like, because I was on when they clinched the World Series or when they won the World Series, and I remember being like, there's a ground ball. Because you can't do the play-by-play,
no,
but you're like,
can't.
This is just wait 5 seconds and I'll be able to say it's over.
That's right.
Right.
There's a batter at the plate in a blue shirt.
Exactly.
He is right-handed. He's on the other side of the plate from what you traditionally think.
Exactly. What do you got tonight?
We have John Tatey from the AV Club. Right. Rich Sunkoff is going to tell us some about the best legal news stories. And we got some tech guys coming up, too. And all kinds of great stuff.
All right. So, we'll have a great show.
There you go.